The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to do a special in-depth original investigative report on our Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we will be sharing 3 hours of programming. And the first hour will be Ian Henshaw, award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book 9/11 Revealed, The New Evidence. He is raising questions about new information that has not been accepted by any of the other media. We will be looking at why. He will be joined by Professor Peter Dale Scott, a former professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and a former Canadian diplomat and a scholar. We will also be joined in this hour by Barbara Honegger. Barbara is a former White House policy analyst and a special assistant to the Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy and a nationally recognized investigator. She is also an expert at testimony at the international hearings on 9/11 in Toronto earlier this month. She also was a senior military affairs journalist at the Department of Defense's Naval Postgraduate School. And she's best known for her book, October Surprise, which exposed the Reagan team's Irangate and led to a full federal investigation in the House. And she is among the first of 50 high-level former and current government officials to call on a new 9/11 investigation in a founding member. She is a founding member of the international organization Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth. In the second hour of our program today, we will be led off by Professor Niels Harrit. He is a professor of chemistry, Department of Chemistry, University of Copenhagen. He'll be speaking to us from Copenhagen. He has new information that has not been released in any form, but will be on this program. Also, time permitting, Professor Lance DeHaven-Smith, professor at the School of Public Administration, policy at Florida State University. He'll be sharing his insights. And rounding out that hour will be Commander Ted Muga. He is a U.S. Naval commander in the Air Force, as well as a Pan Am pilot for many decades. He'll be sharing insights. In the third hour, we will be setting time aside for a commentary, an in-depth commentary that for the first time will give direct evidence of the Saudi royal family involved in the 9/11 incident and their association with the hijackers, the majority of whom were Saudis. She is Annie Malchon, and she is a former intelligence officer with MI5, the UK Security Service, equal to our FBI. And she will tell us for the first time to this audience of known crimes that were committed by MI5, false flag operations, and she will deconstruct the security and intelligence, the war on terror, the media, manipulation, secrecy in legislation, the attack against civil liberties, and the ongoing totalitarianism police state without accountability in the United States and in Great Britain. So that is our panel. We will not have time for calls. Let us begin. We're going to London now. By the way, she is in Germany. We're going to London now and say hello to Ian Henshaw. And I've given you a little background on him. Nice to have you with us, Ian.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Now,
pleasure.
We have done several programs on 9/11. The information shared today, we believe, will be new and take us another step towards demanding a full accountability with a new independent investigation and deconstruction of the official 9/11 report. Now, the question is, why would we be doing this? And we're going to present this information with new evidence, and the media is ignoring this. And we want to respond, and I want you specifically to respond, to the media's techniques, the New York Times, the Times of London, the psychological war around 9/11. Their key technique is to use catch-all arguments to close down debate. The two most common are the conspiracy theory slur, and then they say that a plot could not have been hidden because it would have involved too many people. It would have been too complex. It would have been unfathomable that you could have had that many people working in so many different areas with so many co-conspirators. Couldn't have happened. The FBI would have known about it. The CIA would have known about it. The National Security Agency, which monitors every single email, phone call, and computer in the world, would have known about it. And so the conspiracy theory slur closes down people who want to believe in their government, who want to believe that the authorities would not do this. And this goes along with the straw man argument. They propose a crazy theory and then suggest that this is what all 9/11 skeptics think. In other words, they take the weakest, most absurd, completely non-credible argument made by someone who is called a 9/11 skeptic or truther, and they use that to tar and paint the entire group of outstanding scholars, investigators, and government whistleblowers as if we're all on the same page. We are not. But there are still people who do not buy the conspiracy theory slur. For instance, there are suspicious alternative journalists on the left and right, or those who remember they have been lied to in the past by these same organizations. And the moment you're on the left and you begin to look at information and see that there are holes in the official story, there are contradictions, there are out-and-out misstatements of fact, when you bring your suspicions forward, you are relegated to insignificance and non-relevance. You're considered extreme left. You'll hear that on the left said about people on the left. On the right, when you talk about the same arguments, you're considered an extreme rightist, and you're relegated to the Alex Jones position, even though he has been right. And people who have gotten the truth are now excluded from the left and the right, the official left and the official right. You will not get on MSNBC, Keith Urban, or other shows with this kind of compelling evidence. So I want you to start by taking us through what you have discovered about the official story, its fallacies, and how the media has not once chosen to follow up on any of these statements. Go ahead, please.
Thanks very much, Gary. Can I just start by, I've just looked up this old CIA memo from talking about the Kennedy assassination from way back, but it tells you quite a lot about how they're thinking now. This is what they say about the Kennedy assassination. Innuendo of such seriousness, doubts about the assassination affect the whole reputation of the American government. The aim of this dispatch, this is what they wrote secretly to their CIA stations all over the world, and which undoubtedly also was being done in America as well, we want to inhibit the circulation of such claims in other countries, and to discuss the publicity problem with liaison and friendly contacts, especially politicians and editors. To employ propaganda assets to answer, that means journalists who they control, maybe not unknowingly, but who they control, assets, to answer and refute the attacks of the critics. Book reviews and feature articles are particularly appropriate for this purpose. Now, we can all remember a series of articles that were written by apparent leftists over the last few years, citing very bad evidence. Those of us who knew the subject, we knew that their evidence was coming straight from the worst areas of the official supporters, bad, crude, unscientific evidence that appeared in a magazine called Popular Mechanics. It's now all been refuted, even by the official story, by the way. So, you know, for people who are thinking, gee, you know, could the whole of the media be in on some sort of a plot? Well, the answer, I'm afraid, is yes. They've got the editors, they've got the politicians, they've got their assets. Now, a lot of the people in the mainstream media, of course, are not in these plots, but once you've got the editor, once you've got a loud journalist who everybody trusts, screaming, you know, that we were called, George Monbiot in the London Guardian called 9/11 skeptics a virus. You know, that is Nazi language. So, you know, you can imagine that the honest people on The Guardian, of whom there are, I'm sure, many, are going to be intimidated. So that's how it works. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that, because it's very interesting to see this all in black and white, how they were doing it 30 years ago, and how they're undoubtedly doing it today. But in terms of the new evidence, you can see how they've been manipulating information and playing it down. Information which they can't deny, they marginalize and they bury it. I think there's a well-known saying, I think it's Mencken who said it, the famous American journalist. He said, the thing I like about reading the New York Times is that you never know which page you're going to find the front page story on. So that's, you know, a little joke, but it does tell you something about how they work. For instance, here in England, this is a bit really new, I think, to most people. On page 22 of the Evening Standard, a few months ago, they had the report of the ringleader of the London bombings, which was sort of our equivalent of 9/11. The ringleader is walking free after 2.5 years in custody only, because he made exceptional cooperation with the CIA. Now, that's pretty exceptional cooperation. You know, this is the man responsible for organizing, you know, one of the worst terrorist incidents in Britain ever. There's the front page story buried. So anyway, let's get on to the new information. And undoubtedly, the biggest bombshell, and it's continuing in little bits and pieces scattered around the internet, almost getting into the Washington Post occasionally, is this story about how the CIA did indeed have some sort of plot, and we don't know what the intention of the plot was for sure, but we can surely say that the effect of the plot was to allow the 9/11 attacks to go ahead and be successful. And you don't have to believe me. I've been suspecting this. A lot of us have been suspecting this for many years. We deduced it from the evidence that was available. But you can understand the media. They'd say, well, you know, who's Ian Henshaw? Who's Barbara Honegger? They just dismissed us. But now we've got it from Richard Clarke, who was the head of counterterrorism in the White House at the time of the 9/11 attacks. Now, I'm not saying that Richard Clarke is you know, particularly brave or honest, or that he's not particularly brave or honest. Some people will say this is what's known as a limited hangout. He's admitting it because he's got to admit it, and he's only admitting so much. The fact is that he has now conceded that there was a decision. He calls it a decision. I would call it a plot or a conspiracy, if you like, but it was a decision in the CIA to withhold their dossier on the alleged Al-Qaeda hijackers who went on to carry out the 9/11 attacks. And he is of the opinion that had the CIA acceded to the FBI requests at the time and followed what their legal obligations were, handed over this dossier, which the FBI wanted, then the FBI would have cleared up all those hijackers. They were amateurs. They were not the skillful, super, highly financed, brilliant terrorist, you know, geniuses that the media made out at the time. They were a bunch of very incompetent people. They were all meeting each other. It would have been no trouble at all for the FBI to have unraveled that network and stopped the 9/11 attacks. And just in case people don't believe Richard Clarke, that story has basically been confirmed again by the lead FBI agent at the time, Ali Soufan. He has now come out and said, 2 days after 9/11, they gave me a dossier, and he said, I felt so sick that I went off and I retched up. And what he hasn't said is, I retched up because I realized that the CIA had possibly deliberately allowed the 9/11 attacks to go ahead. So we can't say, intention is very hard to prove. You know, we cannot say necessarily that that was their intention, but we can say that there was some extraordinarily dodgy and quite likely criminal activities going on in the CIA, which led to the 9/11 attacks being successful.
Ian,
but that is a bombshell. Yeah.
Ian, I need you to hold your thoughts. You've opened up a case for us. We're going to invite Dr. Peter Dale Scott, former professor at the University of California and a former diplomat, to carry forward this argument with some detail. Welcome to our program, Dr. Yeah. Scott.
Yes, I'm glad to be with you, and I want to endorse, I would phrase it slightly differently, but the gist of what Ian Henshaw has just said is true. I don't think the most important evidence is Richard Clark, although it does corroborate. There is a fact that is actually being known and has been acknowledged even in a footnote in the 9/11 Commission report, the famous footnote 44. Report came out in 2004, so it's been public for a long time, that the CIA knew that there were two of the hijackers were coming to America. One of them had a multiple entry visa into the United States. This was obviously something which, by their own guidelines, they should have alerted the FBI to. And it was acknowledged that they didn't, and it's worse than that. We're talking about a small group of people in the CIA's Bin Laden unit. They called it Alex Station. And there were not many people there, but they did have somebody over there from the FBI in the CIA station for liaison. And when he saw this information, he immediately drafted a cable back to the FBI to alert them that somebody in Al-Qaeda was coming to America. And he was told in the Bin Laden station not to send that cable. And the very same day, the person who told him not to do it then put out a false cable saying that, in fact, the information had been given to the FBI. Now, that much has been known for a long time, but there's a new book out by a British author, Kevin Fenton, called Disconnecting the Dots, who this fact was investigated by the 9/11 Commission. It provoked a Justice Department investigation of the it was on the FBI side of it, and then eventually the CIA Inspector General also did an investigation of it, and that has not been released. We only have a kind of summary of it. But Kevin Fenton took all the information available from these various sources and showed that it wasn't just on one day this happened. It happened continuously over a period of about 18 months or more, from January 2000 right up until September the 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11 took place. Systematic withholding of information due to the FBI, and incidentally, it was being done in the Alex station, but it was worse than that. The NSA was also getting information about the hijackers and withholding it. Some people may have heard of Able Danger. There was a group in the Special Operations Command that had compiled from open sources information about some of the hijackers, and that was shut down by the Department of Defense. And initially, it looks as if, and this is even being speculated in the New Yorker by Lawrence Wright, it's as I say, not all of this is new. These people, there are two hijackers in particular, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. They came together to Los Angeles in January of 2000, and they were allowed to move around, and it's quite clear that they were getting support from the Saudi embassy. And so the conclusion that is being drawn for some time by outsiders like Lawrence Wright and myself, that this was some kind of CIA-Saudi joint operation, and they wanted it to go forward, and that's why they weren't telling the FBI. That's what you can say about the early stage, but you have to have a different analysis in the last 4 months before 9/11. It's very interesting, and let me just name two people who were central in this withholding of information. The deputy head of the Bin Laden unit, his name was Richard Blee, B-L-E-E, and underneath him a man called Tom Wilshire. And as I say, their behavior, or misbehavior, has been studied many times and a lot of information collected. In May of 2001, Wilshire moves over from the CIA to the FBI and then proceeds to mess things up on the FBI side. He actually initiates, he's getting the files ready, I think. He actually puts into the file that they should look up the information on these people, but he does it in such a way that it's all done very slowly, and someone underneath him is bringing in rules and saying that the FBI criminal agents can't be consulted on this, only the intelligence agents. And the conclusion you have to say is, if this had not gone on, the FBI, if they had known about these two hijackers, as Ian Henshaw said, they were not good spycraft people. They were all in touch with each other. For a certainty, the FBI would have rounded up more than two, maybe the majority of them, long before 9/11. They would have been detained, possibly deported, possibly jailed, and 9/11, as we know it, happened, could not have occurred. So it's very important. It's a matter that shouldn't just concern people curious about 9/11. It should concern anyone who's concerned about law-breaking. The CIA could have contributed to the greatest crime ever committed in this country, the largest mass murder in the history of this country.
Dr. Scott, I need some short answers, if you would, please. Is it accurate to state that the CIA knew of 35 separate episodes of warnings which the FBI were denied information about? There were two guys alone in the FBI who tried to get info on 32 of those 35 and were denied the information.
I wouldn't say that everyone was a denial. Some of the episodes had a slightly different take on it, but the thrust of every one of these 35 episodes was to deny the FBI information. And as you say, nearly all of them are the same small group of people in this CIA bin Laden station.
All right. Is it also accurate that there are people in the White House and in the State Department whose jobs are solely to keep up with 9/11 truth and combat its claims?
Yes, that's true. I was, what Ian Henshaw said about the CIA and the Kennedy assassination is a predecessor, but not as serious, because to my knowledge, they didn't actually appoint someone to tell people that, whose job it was to tell people that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone and performed this brilliant piece of marksmanship. But now we have an official in the State Department, we have an official in the White House, and their job is simultaneously to say that the people who are interested in 9/11 truth are idiots, they're incompetent, they don't have a shred of common sense, and simultaneously to say they're so dangerous that we have to mount a government campaign. It's really a kind of thought control campaign, telling Americans how to think and not to listen to these people.
Okay, I appreciate that input. Please stay on hold. Let me just add, before Barbara Honecker comes on, she is a former White House policy analyst, special assistant to the Assistant to the President on Domestic Policy, and also had worked at the Department of Defense's Naval Postgraduate School, that we had a woman on our last go-around, Susan Lindauer, who is a former U.S. intelligence asset who covered anti-terrorism at the Iraqi embassy in New York, and whose first cousin was Andrew Card, a chief of staff at the White House. She also gave the information to Secretary of State Colin Powell, and that all the claims being made were wrong. She had information about CIA cover-up. She had information about the hijackers. They had great detail, she told me. And up to 200 people within the intelligence community had this information. She was but one, but she had it from the original source, the office she was working with. And so she had, from independent sources, confirmed about the 9/11 hijacking, well in time for it to have been stopped, the people arrested, and it brought to a halt. for her effort, she was the person arrested, later released without any, the indictment against her was completely surrendered. The Justice Department chose to dismiss all charges 5 days before President Obama's inauguration. So it was not that there was no one out there saying that the CIA had information, but it was not the FBI. It was the CIA that was doing the covering up. Let's go over now to Barbara Honecker. Barbara, welcome to our program.
Welcome, Gary. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Thank you. Barbara, I would like for you to address a couple of issues, if you would, and try to be as succinct as possible.
Yes.
The hijack scenario emergency response exercises mirroring the actual attacks planned for and carried out on the morning of 9/11 itself, which put the absolute lie to the Bush and National Security Directorate Condoleezza Rice's claims that the government couldn't have imagined planes being used as weapons when they already were doing exercises in anticipation of that. Could you take us through what you have found in the official version of events, or out-and-out lies, and your facts to respond to them?
Oh, yes, and thank you for asking the question, and thanks also to Ian Henschel for requesting that I focus on this today. As you mentioned, Gary, Condoleezza Rice and President Bush famously said immediately after the 9/11 attacks that neither of them could have possibly imagined terrorists using planes as weapons to slam into buildings, etc. Well, we now know that that was a horrendous and proven lie. And how do we know that? Because it is impossible for anyone not to have imagined using planes as weapons and also be doing emergency exercise drills on that very scenario, hijack scenarios, that morning of 9/11 itself, which is in fact the case. We now know that there were indeed 46 military intelligence counterterrorism drills and emergency response exercises practicing different aspects of the actual pending 9/11 attacks leading up to 9/11, and 22 of those 46 actually held on the morning of 9/11 itself, which is an amazing fact, but it is one that has now been confirmed publicly by Colonel Robert Marr, Air Force Colonel Robert Marr, who was the battlefield commander at NORAD's Northeast Sector on 9/11. Now, NORAD is the Air Force agency which was in the Northeast Sector. They have five sectors in the country. The Northeast Sector, out of Rome, New York, Griffith Air Force Base, is the sector that was supposed to scramble planes to military interceptors to all four of the planes that were allegedly hijacked on the morning of 9/11. And as we know famously from the work of the 9/11 Truth Movement, did not do so for over an hour and a half. So one of the great mysteries of 9/11 is why weren't those NORAD planes scrambled? Well, we now know part of that answer. And at least for the original critical 15 to 20 minutes, we now know both from audio tapes, some of which were actually played in the 9/11 Commission hearings, and you can hear much more of it on the NORAD tapes that you can actually hear on the Vanity Fair website to this day, online, on the Internet. We know that that NORAD was confused in its Northeast Sector, where Colonel Bob Marr was the battlefield commander, because they weren't sure when the actual squawks started coming in from Boston Air Traffic Control and other air traffic controllers about information that apparently there were hijacks on the morning of 9/11. They weren't sure if it was the exercise or real world. And their people who needed to make decisions as to scrambling planes and whether to let them actually take off after they were geared up on the tarmac, they weren't sure as to whether it was real world or exercise, which caused a critical confusion and therefore delay of at least the first 15 to 20 minutes, which is what really mattered for the first two planes. Now, this shocking fact, as I mentioned, has not only now been confirmed by Colonel Robert Marr himself in a book called Touching History by Lynn Spencer, which I highly recommend everyone get and read, but also, amazingly, by Bush's counterterrorism czar before and on and after 9/11, Richard Clark. Now, Richard Clark came to the Naval Postgraduate School, where I was senior military affairs journalist until just this June 10th. I just recently retired from 15 years in that position. And he came to the Naval Postgraduate School about a year ago, And he gave the Secretary of the Navy's guest lecture, and then he gave a smaller presentation to a public gathering in our main building, in our administration building. And in that lecture, I asked him a question in the Q's and A's, which caused him to acknowledge that there was confusion at NORAD Northeast Sector on the morning of 9/11 due to the emergency response counterterrorism exercises being held that very morning of 9/11 as the actual attacks were taking place on a mirror image scenario of a hijack scenario. So we have the White House counterterrorism czar himself, as well as the battlefield commander at the very place, NORAD's Northeast Sector, that didn't timely scramble the planes to the four allegedly hijacked planes. We have confirmations from both of them publicly. And I'll just conclude, Gary, with, and then you can ask further detailed questions, of course. I'll just conclude with the amazing fact that Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, which is his book about the 9/11 attacks and the response to them, or I would say non-response, on page 5 of Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, he mentions in the introduction that the book was pre-vetted and therefore able to be censored by the White House, by Condoleezza Rice herself, the National Security Advisor at the time, his boss, by Bush, Cheney, by anyone in the White House. And they only censored one place in the book. It's the only place in the book with three dots, ellipses, dot, dot, dot. And that is where Richard Clark on page 5 mentions Vigilant Guardian, which was one of the most important of those 22 military intelligence exercises, one of those that was on a hijack scenario itself being run on the morning of 9/11. The hijack scenario exercises being run by our military intelligence community across the entire United States, not just in Northeast Sector, on the morning of 9/11, is the smoking gun, or one of the major smoking guns of 9/11, and they're scared to death. The public will know the truth, and that's why it's the only place in Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies, that has been censored.
I appreciate you sharing this with us. Now, in our next hour, we will have Commander Ted Muga, who is a very experienced pilot. He was the commander in the Navy of a whole squadron. He is a master pilot, and he will be giving us why he believes the attack on the Pentagon has not been fully explained to his or hundreds of other pilots who meet regularly, he states, to their satisfaction. But,
correct.
However, I know that you have specific ideas about why we should be challenging the official version of what happened. Now, at the risk, and I don't mind, I can take this program as long as I want. We'll just preempt some shows afterwards. I will extend this program by giving you an additional opportunity to lay out your facts.
Yes.
And in why you believe that what we were told as the official story, at least involving the Pentagon, why that must be held in a position of challenge. And do that first. I have another area for you to go into. And with each of our guests, if you have something that you feel is absolutely relevant, I will extend the time so we do not limit what you have to say. So the forum is yours. Take us through this. And do so, please, as you well know, in a forensic style. In other words, give what they state and how you deconstruct it and what evidence you have that will deconstruct their arguments.
Yes. And Gary, would you like me to do this now or after Captain Muga speaks?
No, right now.
Oh, okay, fine. Yes, well, what Gary Null has just asked me to do, and because I know that time is limited, there are many guests on this program, what I will do is I will give a thumbnail sketch, and then anyone who would like more information can get to Gary, and he will forward it to me, and I will give you my full PowerPoint presentation on this subject that was just presented at the Toronto hearings in Toronto, Canada.
But you don't have to be so circumspect. You have to elucidate to where we have a full picture. This is a very important program, as I said. It's planned for 3 hours, but if I have to go 3.5 hours, even 4 hours, I will not limit the truth coming out today because of some artificial time restraint.
Okay, I understand. So I don't need to be too brief. All right. I'm going to give an overview of the facts, and these are facts. These are not theories. the facts that I presented as the only invited expert witness purely on the Pentagon attack at the recent Toronto hearings on the attacks of 9/11, which were held about 2 weeks ago in Toronto, Canada. The bottom line is this. The official story, first I'm going to begin with the official lie, it's called the official narrative of 9/11, and then I'm going to show you why it is false in every regard. The official story of 9/11 claims that Flight 77, which was a large commercial airliner, Boeing 757, impacted the west face of the Pentagon just above the ground level, kind of at the height, the higher end of the first floor and the lower end of the second floor, and slammed into the building at an oblique diagonal angle from the right going to the left, to the right of the heliport, and slammed into the building at exactly 9:37 and 46 seconds, Gary. That's almost 9:38 in the morning. It's very important, the time. They insist it's just before 9:38. And that plane went through 6 feet of concrete reinforced walls with Kevlar reinforcement that had just been added to the walls in the reinforcement of the building. And in addition to that, about 5 inches or more of brick, and in addition to that, a few inches of limestone on the outside, and went through obliquely 310 feet in and just popped its nose or some large heavy part of the plane out of what they call the exit hole on the inside of the C ring. Now the C ring is the third ring in the Pentagon. There are 5 rings. The outside ring is the E ring, then it goes to D and C, B and A. So the inside ring closest to the center courtyard is the A ring. Well, the first fact that shows that this is an abominable lie and a blood libel, actually, on not only the American people but the world population, is that we have absolute proof from eyewitnesses inside the building on 9/11 itself, from all across the military, who gave their testimony not only to myself under oath but also to the Washington Post the very morning of 9/11, that went on to the Washington Post online website immediately, that there was massive destruction, fire damage, huge heat, and death in the two rings inside of the middle or C ring, which the official story says the plane only barely popped its nose out of. So it is impossible for the official story to be true if a plane only went through the middle C ring and yet there's massive damage and death. In fact, according to the witnesses on the morning of 9/11 itself, and some that I have under oath, including April Gallup, an extremely important witness whose desk was only about 35 feet from the alleged entrance hole of Flight 77 on the morning of 9/11, she and many other witnesses saw no plane, no plane parts, no seats, no luggage, no smell of jet fuel, no jet fuel fires. The only fires they saw were coming out of the computers in the ring around the large army area, which had the most deaths of any part of the Pentagon on 9/11, and April Gallup and others walked out through the alleged entrance hole, had no burns on their body. I have photographs of her on the lawn afterwards with her infant son, showing her feet, one of which was bare. She had only one shoe as she walked out. Her feet are unburned. The official story cannot be true on those two grounds. And then I'll move on. The official story says that there was only one exit hole, that the alleged nose of the plane, according to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's claim on national television, or according to the Pentagon Building Performance Report, they claim that rather than the nose, some heavy part like an engine of the plane smashed through the inside of the third ring, but not an inch further. And yet, we have photographs that I have found from the Department of Defense's own website immediately after the attacks, showing not one exit, so-called exit hole, but three, right in a row with each other. And in fact, the Department of Defense gave that information to the Washington Post right after the attacks, and the Washington Post published it the next morning in a graphic, which makes it very clear that those three exit points are labeled exit holes, plural, and they're labeled 1, 2, and 3, and they're coded and alleged in orange. And now I have aerial photographs from the Department of Defense website itself showing those three exit holes. So let's go back. The official story says that Flight 77, a large commercial airliner, plowed into the building, went only at the very most inside the third ring of five in, and yet there are massive damage and deaths in the two rings further in than that. And the official story says that it poked its nose or some large heavy piece of the plane only just outside the third ring in, and yet there are not just one exit hole, but three, according to the Department of Defense itself. You know, Gary, I could go on, and if you'd like me to give more evidence, I will, but I think you get the picture.
Okay, I do want you to give more, but I have a question.
Yes.
I have studied for this program the last 30 years of plane crashes around the world. Without exception, every single plane crash, there is substantial amounts of debris, bodies thrown out of the crash, depending upon where it lands. It could be over several miles. The fuselage, these very heavy-duty engines, some with titanium parts that you cannot destroy by normal heat. How much of the plane that hit the building is left to identify?
Right. If that's your question, precious little, assuming that it's part of a plane at all. There are little tiny chaff-like pieces of what appear to be aluminum scattered over the heliport and a portion of the lawn. But if a large commercial airliner came in that low, as I'm sure that Captain or Commander Ted Buga will point out, he was a Top Gun Navy pilot later in this program, if it is impossible, according to pilots whom I have interviewed, including not only Ted Buga, but Ralph Kolstedt. Ralph Kolstedt was a Top Gun Navy pilot who went on to become a pilot for American Airlines and actually flew Flight 77's route. And he said that he could not do the maneuver that the official story alleges, and a totally incompetent pilot, Hani Hanjour, who couldn't, according to the official story, who couldn't even fly a Cessna. His flight instructor said he couldn't even fly a Cessna, a very small twin-engine plane. It would be impossible for a Top Gun Navy pilot to have flown the steep, very fast, almost 330-degree loop that the official story says Flight 77, this huge commercial airliner, came down and came in just above the ground level. Many of these pilots have said it's impossible for it to have done that that actual trajectory, number one. But number two, there's something called the ground effect, where you cannot go over a certain speed, and the speed that the official story says Flight 77 came in on, about 540 to 560 miles an hour, is well above the speed above which all of these pilots have said it is totally impossible for a plane to get closer to the ground than the width of one wing if the plane were turned 90 degrees from where it comes in without breaking up. And also, if the plane came in that low, from photographs, as you know, Gary, from all over the Internet, there would have been massive damage, fuselages, large pieces of wings. There would have been, and also, it's very important for people to understand that the west wing, the west wedge of the Pentagon, the west whole portion of the Pentagon, of the five sides, had just been upgraded to withstand precisely this kind of an attack. So it is, in my opinion, my very studied opinion, physically impossible for the minor, small pieces of chaff-like aluminum to have come from a large commercial airliner impacting the building, and the amount of debris that would have to be there, and the gouge in the lawn, none of it is present. Absolutely none of it.
All right. Well, we will hold the thought of what it could have been. Why not simply have the Pentagon release photographs from the multiple cameras that would have caught the plane coming in from, I think, two filling stations, three buildings, plus the Pentagon security cameras themselves, which give a large protective perimeter to the Pentagon, and
yes,
that way it settles the argument, and there's no more argument.
Well, obviously the answer is, in fact, there were 85 video camera tapes that were immediately confiscated by the FBI on the morning of 9/11. And you have to ask yourself, how did they know in advance to be there so quickly? Because those tapes, some of them were ripped. The entire cameras were ripped off the wall, for instance, at the Citgo gas station in the first 5 minutes after the attack. So these 85 videotapes, obviously, if they supported the official conspiracy theory of 9/11, that Flight 77 impacted the building just above ground level, going at 540 to 560 miles an hour. If it supported that in any way, they would have, of course, released them. But the FBI has only released two videotapes. And one of those two videotapes, they were both from security lot, parking lot security cameras, just a few feet from each other in the parking lot on 9/11. And one of those two security tapes has the so-called famous five frames that were actually leaked in early 2002. They weren't officially released, but in 2006, in the Mousawi trial, the so-called famous first believed 20th hijacker, Zacharias Mousawi, in his sentencing hearing and trial, the FBI released the actual two videotapes, from which one of is the famous five frames. And a private citizen, like ourselves, Gary, asked the FBI, prior to the Mousawi trial, to check and view all 85 videotapes that were confiscated by the FBI in 9/11 at and around the Pentagon, at the Sheraton Hotel, at the Citgo gas station, around the Pentagon itself, and to get back to the private citizen with an analysis of all 85 tapes and let him know which, if any, of them supported the official story of an impact. And the FBI got back, the FBI Freedom of Information Officer got back in an official letter that you can see on the Internet and told him the bottom line of the analysis was she had looked at all 85 and only two were responsive to his request. And obviously, Gary, those are the two that were released in the Mousawi trial, of which one of the two is the same as five frames. And as you know, there's no plane in those five frames. So the FBI doesn't have any videos or photographs supporting the official story, is the answer to your question.
Go to the clock. The difference in the time.
Yes. All right. What Gary is asking about from my Toronto hearings testimony is the fact that the official story of 9/11, as embodied in the 9/11 Commission report, claims that Flight 77, a large commercial airliner, struck the west side of the Pentagon just above ground level at exactly 9:37 and 46 seconds, just before 9:38 in the morning. And they take that time from the flight data recorder, which they claim they found just inside that C-ring exit hole, which we have already seen, Gary, is not an exit hole at all and is one of only three. So they take the time from the flight data recorder. Now, pilots for 9/11 Truth, as Ted Muga will probably get into, have analyzed the data from the flight data recorder, which has been released by the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, and they have discovered that the data on the flight data recorder itself makes clear that whatever plane that was, it could not have been Flight 77. So whatever plane that was, it may have come close to the Pentagon, close to 9:38, but according to their analysis, it was very high over the roof of the Pentagon. The Pentagon is only about 71 to 73 feet high, all five of its stories. And their analysis of the flight data recorder data released by the U.S. government itself shows that the plane went hundreds of feet over the roof. So number one, the flight data recorder isn't from that plane at all, and it's that flight data recorder that gives the official story time of impact. Well, so I've just given a context to answer your question. What I have discovered, not only from research on the Internet, but interviewing under oath witnesses at the Pentagon, what we have learned also from photographs of clocks that were stopped at the moment of the first violent event at the Pentagon, one of which is even the official clock representing the Pentagon attack in the Smithsonian Institution September 11th exhibit. This is the official clock. These clocks, including a Navy clock from the Naval Command Center, one from the heliport right outside the West Wall, they're all stopped right after 9:30. One of them is stopped at 9:31 and 30 seconds, another is stopped at 9:31 and 40 seconds, and these are independently set clocks, of course. And then April Gallup, I mentioned her before. She's a very important witness. Her desk was only about 35 feet from the alleged impact hole of Flight 77. And when she pressed the on button on her computer on the morning of 9/11, she'd been away for pregnancy and childbirth leave for about three months, she came into her desk, she pressed the on button on her computer, and instantly this massive explosion happened that really should, in all probability, have killed both her and her infant son, who was with her in a stroller by her desk, but they miraculously survived. They came out the entrance hole with no damage to themselves, no fire, no jet fuel, saw no planes, no plane parts, and her wristwatch, Gary, stopped at just after 9:30, exactly the time of the stopped clocks inside the two most damaged sections of the Pentagon, the Navy and the Army area. So the official story time taken from the flight data recorder, which pilots for 9/11 Truth, has proven isn't from Flight 77 anyway. The official story time is off by at least 6 minutes.
All right, just a couple more points, which I believe is very important for our audience. Let's go back then to the other aspects of this. Take a look at the most glaring examples of misinformation within the official record of 9/11 on anything that occurred now in New York pre or post the tragedy that you would like to offer a challenge to, and I will offer the same opportunity to Peter Dale Scott and to Ian in just a moment after you so that we cover all the bases before we go to our next guest.
All right. I've spoken for quite a while, so what I will do is I will just emphasize what I believe is the most important point of my research on 9/11 at the Pentagon. And because I have focused all my work on the Pentagon and not at Pennsylvania or New York City. So on the Pentagon, the most important piece of information for people to realize is that the real story at the Pentagon on 9/11 is exactly the same as the real story that the government is covering up at the World Trade Center, and that is inside the building explosives, Gary. There were massive inside-the-building explosives at the Pentagon. In fact, the day after 9/11, the Washington Post had a story called The Targeted Ones about the targeting of the Naval Command Center at 9/11, and that's where one of those stopped clocks stopped just after 9:30. There were massive explosions on the inside of the Pentagon. There were massive explosions, as we know, from Neil Tarrant's work. We're going to hear from him later in the program. Richard Gage, Professor Stephen Jones, and others analyzing the content of the dust that was in the air from the collapse of the World Trade Centers. We know that there was military-grade nanothermite, which is a incendiary explosive, that was throughout the Twin Towers, so that the real story of how they came down by controlled demolition, in the case of World Trade Center 7, not hit by any plane at all, it came down by a classic controlled demolition with pre-placed internal explosive charges, and the World Trade Centers 1 and 2 came down by controlled demolition with nanothermite, but in a non-traditional controlled demolition, and Neil Tarrant could explain the difference between those two. So the bottom line is, the real story of 9/11 is targeted inside the building explosives, both at the World Trade Centers in New York and at the Pentagon.
Okay, just one question. If you have information, fine. If you don't, we'll leave it at that. I have been given information from a source in Washington that at the time of 9/11, and again, it may have been purely coincidence, that there was a group of auditors in the Pentagon exactly where this terrorist attack occurred.
Yes.
That they were doing an audit to try to see where hundreds of billions of dollars had gone missing through the military procurement process. Have you heard any of that?
Well, not only have I heard it, I was the researcher who first put that out and realized it and connected those dots, actually.
Okay, I didn't know of that.
Yeah.
I just heard it. Give us what your take is on that.
Yes. I will tell you what we know. What we know is that the day before 9/11, on September 10th, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld both held a press conference and testified in Congress to the effect that his agency, the Department of Defense, was missing, and I put that in quotes, missing, could not account for, it wasn't just hundreds of billions, Gary, it was $2.3
trillion.
Trillion with a T. Now, and that you can see him saying that on video from ABC News or one of the major networks, which I will be happy to send you. Now, the $2.3 trillion, to put that in perspective, $2.3 trillion, according to the most conservative estimate of what the cost has been, the direct cost for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq for an entire decade, for 10 years, it's $1 trillion. So almost 2.5 times the amount of money the United States has spent on both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's what Donald Rumsfeld said publicly in official testimony and in a press conference the day before 9/11, September 10th, that his agency, the Department of Defense, could not find. It was missing. Now, the next day, one of the areas that was, in my opinion, targeted. And why do we believe that? Because there were two areas of the Pentagon with concentrated damage and deaths. One was the Army Administrative Area, which included a very large number of financial auditors, as well as the Naval Command Center, which was a different area a little bit further in the Pentagon from the Army area, which the Army area was on the outside E-ring, which the official story says Flight 77 hit. All right. So what we do know is that one of the two most damaged areas where April Gallup, witness April Gallup's desk was, by the way, in part of that large Army administrative area, she was a declassification expert, actually, that morning. The Army area was one of the two most damaged areas in the sense that it had the most absolute number of deaths and was massively destroyed. It was a miracle April Gallup and others survived from that area at all. There were a large number of auditors. It is my working hypothesis, which I was the first to publish, putting those two dots together, that once you realize that the real story at the Pentagon, as well as the World Trade Center, is targeted, it is inside the building, explosives, bombs, if you will, incendiary explosives of some kind, then you realize they can be set to take out particular functions, offices, and even individuals. So once you realize that, you realize that they could very well have taken out the auditors who were trying to follow that money. And in Watergate, you remember Deep Throat told Bob Woodward, follow the money and you will crack the case. Now, that is a working hypothesis. And I have also interviewed others. I interviewed a Fort Monmouth, that is an Army base in New Jersey, Fort Monmouth. And there was a auditor, a financial auditor from Fort Monmouth. He and his supervisor and another auditor were TDY, that's temporary duty assigned to the Pentagon, before 9/11 and on 9/11. And he had just visited, I've interviewed him under oath, he had just visited this Army financial audit area because he had been special assigned to the Pentagon to try to track this kind of money, this missing money, and had just left to go get a cup of coffee at the cafeteria by the south side entrance when he said literally hundreds of workers, Pentagon workers, staff members, raced down the hall past him screaming, a bomb, bombs went off. It was a bomb. Oh, my God, bombs. So he just escaped with his life. And I asked him, this is his opinion, but it's a very informed opinion. I asked him if he believed that the auditors in the Army area could have been tracking, trying to locate that missing $2.3 trillion. He said yes, and he also told me that regardless, that all of the documents were destroyed.
Okay, again, this is a hypothesis. We do not have hard proof of this.
No.
And we will make sure that people underline this is merely a hypothesis. Final question, have they concluded that audit? Have they discovered where that money went?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. Not only have they not, but believe it or not, the Pentagon acknowledged just about a week ago that now they can't find $10 trillion.
Are you sure you're not referring to billion?
No, trillion with a T. I'll prove it to you, Gary.
Okay, I saw where they released a report on billions, but I haven't seen the evidence yet on trillions. That would be rather remarkable because, for a simple point, if you go back and look at each year's defense budget on and offline, it was anywhere between $300 billion, another $100 billion offline for other agencies that are come underneath its purview, and never was it higher than $600 billion. So that meant that you would be dealing with the full budget request for years and years, and that assumes that they didn't use that money for anything except somewhere kept it, or it means that they did spend it and spend it on what they promised to spend it on, but they had no accurate records of it. So we are left with questions without answers at this point. Thank you for that part of your investigation.
Well, if I might, just one more sentence. Or, obviously, what it would mean, and it is trillions, I will prove that to you. The claim by Rumsfeld was trillions, not billions. What that would mean is that there was a piece of each year's budget that went into black operations of some kind, and that it built up and they didn't want to acknowledge it. That's the more likely explanation.
Well, here's my thought. We were not aware that the Federal Reserve was giving large amounts of money to people that they were close to, banks, Wall Street firms, hedge funds, equity partnerships, banks and companies outside the United States, and major Fortune 500 companies, including Verizon and McDonald's.
Yes.
But they did. We only found this out when 22,000 separate transactions occurred. We were not given any information on what they gave as collateral, but we do know that they were given the money at 0.25% interest or zero interest. We then found out that they also separately, and this is due to Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, that he found out that there was $16.1 trillion given by the Federal Reserve that is not in anyone's budget. In other words, it's not declared a debt or a liability, even though it is, because it's fiat currency. There's nothing backing it up. And given out to the same cast of characters. Now, when you add the $3.1 trillion, $16.1 trillion, and the $748 billion from the first bailout, you're dealing at $20 trillion in a period of 3 years.
Yeah,
and that was, with the exception of the first bailout that the public knew about, the other two we did not know about. We only heard of a word, quantitative easing, part one and part two, but no real figures. And what we were finally given were wrong. So is it possible that enormous amounts of money were given without the public being aware of it? Yes, it is. But that is merely a hypothesis. Barbara, thank you very much. I appreciate your input. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a brief music break and come back, continue with our panelists. Next up will be Professor Niels Herit. He will be providing new information you have not heard before and that has been tested. The actual information and the science behind it has actually been tested. I will let him describe some startling new information. Please stay with us. We say hello to a gentleman where we're going to go to Denmark. He is Professor Niels Herit, H-A-R-R-I-T, is associate professor in the chemistry department, University of Copenhagen, where he has taught for the past 35 years. He is one of the lead scientists and authors of the important paper, Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe, which was published in the peer-reviewed journal, the Open Chemical Physics Journal. He is well known throughout Europe for his investigations in alternative causes for the collapse of three buildings on 9/11. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, I'm here. Thank you. And thank you for being on your show.
Would you please take us first through what your investigation has historically shown, that there were materials, thermitic materials, that have been used and are used in that create high temperatures, high enough to melt metal, that were used at 9/11, found at 9/11, but you have new information to share with us about nanothermite. Since thermite has been around for a while, how is nanothermite different from what it just regular thermite, and also the compounds added to this thermite, which implies a high degree of sophistication, thought, and deep knowledge of high-tech explosives? This is not something your regular chemist could do. They do not have either the means or the knowledge to do this. And that leads me to, who do you know would have the sophistication, the means of getting the materials, the means of being able to create this demolition, and the means to cover it up? Take us through your analysis of the material, please.
Well, the history of the nanothermite actually dates back to 2002-2003 by the release of a report from a private company called the R.J. Lee Group. They were involved in an insurance case, and they had to make to characterize the World Trade Center dust. And this they did for Deutsche Bank, which was neighbor to the South Tower, which collapsed, as we all know. And in their report, among a wealth of other things, they told us about the occurrence of iron spheres. These are very tiny balls, spheres, in huge abundance. And this observation remained unexplained, actually, for a number of years. The same information also appeared in a report from United States Geological Survey in 2005. And the point being that these kinds of iron spheres can only be explained by the application of thermite. Thermite is actually an old investigation. It was discovered by a German chemist called Hans Goldschmidt in 1893. It was patented in 1898 and applied for the first time in 1899 because it's a very useful thing for welding. Point being that it is a chemical mixture of iron oxide, which we could call rust, and aluminum. Elemental aluminum and very tiny, finely divided powder. And when these two, when rust and aluminum dust is mixed, if you can make them react, you form iron at a very, very high temperature, 2,500 degrees centigrade. I don't know how much it is in Fahrenheit, but it's more than enough to melt iron. And So the iron coming out of this process can be used for welding, for instance, tram rails and ordinary rails. Now, so much for thermite itself, and it has been used for destroying other steel items like armor. If you put it into grenades or torpedoes and configure them in specific ways so that the thermite mixture actually is blown out of a container, it can be used for destroying armor. Now, what we have, and there are many evidences for the thermite was used for the demolition of the three towers on Manhattan. And, I will not make an account of all the observations, but I think I have a list of about 11 different observations pointing in the same direction. But what's happened in 2006 and 2007 is that Professor Stephen E. Jones from the Brigham Young University in Utah decided to take a closer look on the dust based on these very early reports from the RJ Lee Group and the United States Geological Survey. And he found, as the first one, these tiny red-gray chips, which we have to talk about now. And I was eventually afterwards invited onto the team who have been investigating these findings. And after 18 months, I believe, we came out with this publication, which you just mentioned. Now, the finding, the basic finding, is very, very tiny particles. We call them red-gray chips because they're flat like cornflakes, but they're much, much smaller. You need a microscope actually to see them. They're red on one side, they're gray on the other side. And the red side is the interesting thing here because it displays all the characteristics of a thermite reaction when you heat them up. Most basically, the fundamental observation is that elemental iron is being formed, exactly as in the good old thermite from Hans Goldschmidt's days. You form elemental iron when you heat up this material. The difference between the old-fashioned thermite and this material, which we call nanothermite, is that for once that the particles are smaller, meaning that they react much faster than the good old thermite. There's been experiments made that you can actually accelerate the reaction by a factor of 100. Next, the particles are embedded in what we call a polymer matrix. You may call it a plastic, meaning that the particles are in a plastic. And this is the key, actually, for using the power of the thermite reaction and make it do other things than just developing a tremendous heat. I must stress that this is actually what the findings show so far, and if we go beyond this point, we are becoming speculative, but I'm ready to do that.
Have you found any thermitic materials in the lungs or blood of individuals who were at 9/11 on ground level?
Actually, I don't know. You are tapping accidentally into some very, very recent findings that I have done here in Copenhagen. Maybe we should save it just a little. I don't know. But, okay. The answer is yes. And it gets even more complicated because it relies on a publication which came out April last year, 2010, from a group of scientists on the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, a very respectable medical school. And they looked at the lung tissue from some of the first responders. As we, maybe all of us know, there were thousands, tens of thousands of people who rushed into New York City and to take care of the rescue and also, of course, city officials, firemen, policemen, you name it. It has been estimated roughly that between 60 and 70,000 people were exposed to the World Trade Center dust because, as we just heard, the buildings were completely pulverized from the demolitions except for the structural steel. Everything was pulverized, and some of it very, very finely pulverized. And believe me, I just recall the other day I again had the World Trade Center dust under a microscope, and it looks nasty. It's not very healthy to breathe. Believe me, this must have been terrible. And we should remember also that the Environmental Protection Agency, during the first week after 9/11, actually they issued, as I understand, 11 statements saying that the air was safe to breathe. And people have speculating that they were more concerned about the reopening of Wall Street than they were about the health of the first responders. But getting back to this investigation by the Mount Sinai group, Mount Sinai Medical School group, they looked at the lung tissue from seven of these first responders. Some of them were already there on the 11th, and some of them were there from the 12th on. Some of them were working for many hundred hours in the following weeks in Ground Zero. And they found in four out of these seven first responders, they found a material called carbon nanotubes in the lung tissue. And this is a genuine scientific publication. You can see the electron microscope pictures of these carbon nanotubes, and I'll explain in a while what we're talking about here. And you can also see carbon nanotubes in the World Trade Center dust. Now, carbon nanotubes is another buzzword in the age of nanotechnology. As indicated, they're very, very tiny tube structures made of carbon, meaning that if somebody out there knows what graphite is made of layers of carbon, and if you imagine you take such a layer and fold it into a tubing, this is what we're talking about. The dimensions varies a lot because you have single-walled carbon nanotubes and you have multiple-walled carbon nanotubes, but we are in the nanometer range, and a nanometer is 1/1000000th of a millimeter, so it is 1/1000000th of a millimeter. And say if you take 20 nanometers, this is the thickness, the typical thickness of these carbon nanotubes, but they're very, very long. And the carbon nanotubes is really a hot item in modern nanotechnology because they have sensational properties. The mechanical properties are outrageous. It's several hundred times stronger than spiderweb, etc. So they have been really subject to a huge research. Not so many has investigated actually how they are formed, and this is where I have been speculating for a long time since this paper came out last year from the Mount Sinai Hospital. Where did these nanotubes come from, and how did they end up in the lungs of the first responders? Obviously from breathing, but why carbon nanotubes are formed also in the environment from diesel exhaust and stuff like that, but not in quantities like this. And the control group in the Mount Sinai investigation were 40 patients, construction workers, plumbers, electricians, who have been exposed to asbestos. And of course they have a huge bank of lung tissue from this kind of patients. And none of them, they found carbon nanotubes. So apparently carbon nanotubes is specific for people who got what you say innocently is called the World Trade Center cough. But the fact is that thousands of these people are getting very, very seriously ill, and many have died already. So it seems to be specific for World Trade Center responders, and of course, as a chemist, I have been speculating where do they come from. Carbon nanotubes, formation of carbon nanotubes, are conditioned by three circumstances. One is you need high temperature. Second, you need a source of carbon. And this is where the plastic, which the nanothermite is embedded in, comes into play. This plastic could be the source of carbon. And the third condition for formation of nanotubes is a catalyst, and this should be a metal catalyst, and among the most efficient is iron. So formation of carbon nanotubes a priori seems to be very favorable, could be all the conditions are there in the thermite reaction, the nanothermite reaction, because we have a carbon source. You don't have that in ordinary thermite. But in nanothermite, we have a carbon source in this polymer embedded. So the story is that Kevin Ryan, who is a co-author of the paper you quoted and a good friend and 9/11 activist, and he did a nanothermite reaction. He prepared nanothermite, and maybe now we come to your part of your first question. Now, who could possibly have prepared this? We know that research into explosives and incendiaries and propellants based on nanotechnology took speed in the early 90s. And you know, I'm not an American. I'm sitting far away, so I can only drop names and point at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, the Los Alamos National Laboratory. But over the years, and particularly after 9/11, many major American universities have research programs into these kind of energetic materials based on nanotechnology. So what Kevin did was he took one of the published recipes for the preparation of nanothermite and did a batch in his backyard. It's all has been documented on the web. There's a video there. He's preparing the stuff, and he's making it react. And you can see how it blows off the lid of the container and stuff like that. Point is that the ashes, the remnants from this reaction, he sent to me a month ago. And I have access to a very good electron microscope. And we looked for carbon nanotubes in the nanothermite reaction products. And I believe I found it. This is very recent. It's preliminary experiments. But you ask me if there is a link between the nanothermite and the illnesses of the first responders. I believe that I have a very good lead, and this is where my mind is set for the time
All right, this is very important because this shows many of the people with illnesses, especially upper respiratory illnesses. One of the problems is, do we connect the nanothermites to the explosion? Do we connect the nanothermites in the air to a person's adverse health? You seem to have answered both of those. Now, I need some short answers here, but give us the best that you have on these three points. This is not something that some Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia could have come up with. How much nanothermitic material would have been needed to bring down these three buildings? That's one, and two, how long would it have taken someone to have put this in there, and could this have been detonated remotely? Take us through those three.
Well, what was the first one?
How much, the actual quantity.
Okay.
I mean, you're bringing down some big buildings. You need, I'm going to assume you need a lot of this nanothermitic material.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
This we don't know. I mean, usually I don't indulge in hypothetical blast scenarios. But if you do, I mentioned in the beginning of my account before the report from the RJ Lee Group, and they actually put numbers on how much of the iron spheres they have detected in the dust. And from that one, you can make a back calculation and say, now how much nanothermite, you have an idea how much dust was formed at all. And as somebody say it was 1.5 million tons, metric tons. But even if it's a very conservative estimate, if you say how much thermite do we need to account for the finding of the iron spheres, the numbers coming out of that is astronomers. I will not say it here because it's obviously too big to be explained from nanothermite alone. And this is an important point. And also,
the question you may raise here was the sample which the RJ Lee Group obtained from the Deutsche Bank, which is a building across the street. Is this representative for the bulk of the dust? Probably not. But what I think is that the material they sampled on in Deutsche Bank was not blown over there. It was thrown over there, because when you see the collapse of the South Tower, you can see how the girders and the steel beams are being hurled upwards and thrown across the street. So I think this number is too high, but still there's plenty of headroom for the amount of thermite which has been applied, which lead us to another finding in which I'm not involved, namely by the researchers on the Worcester Technical University, who found sulfidation of some steel beams. I will not go into technical detail with this because it's a radio program. We really need some pictures to explain that. But it indicates the application of another form of thermite material, which is called thermate. It's spelled differently. And the difference between thermate and thermite is that in thermate, you add sulfur to the mix. And the reason for doing it is because it makes the mixture cut through steel beams much easier, like a hot knife through butter. And my present picture of the collapse scenario, which I have only very recently told anybody about in the public domain, is that the core structures, I believe at present, that the core columns were cut by thermate, which is ideal for cutting steel beams, while the nanothermite we're talking about here actually were applied to some of the perimeter columns. And this, maybe I should come back to this later, and this is based on the visual evidence from the collapses of the towers. Add to this explosives, because there is no doubt that explosives were used. We are approaching a very sophisticated and detailed collapse scenario involving explosives and two kind of thermitic materials. I have to bring in another concept, actually, which is a propellant. This is what people would call rocket fuel. Because what a person like David Chandler, he's a physics teacher from California, and he has made some very instructive videos and really pointed that he's an excellent teacher. And what he's doing is basically he's saying, look, please take a look. And he guided us through just taking a proper look. And what you see from the South Tower exploding, you're seeing fragments being thrown upwards. That's one thing. This is not something you can expect from a collapse driven by gravity only. But you also see fragments which are changing directions. They're acting exactly like rockets. So you could call rocket-like fragments coming out. You see fragments moving to the ground faster than free fall. This is impossible unless there is a driving force. And you see fragments exploding after they have been thrown out from the South Tower. You see a fragment changing direction 90 degrees. So what we are witnessing here is a material which is an explosive. Well, yes. Is an incendiary? Oh, yes. Because we have lots of supporting evidence for that. Is it rocket fuel? Well, yes. It is really some kind of the old concepts cannot either alone, each one of them, describe what we are witnessing if we take a closer look at the collapse of the towers. So my present scenario in my mind at the present requires explosives and thermite for cutting the core columns, and maybe our red grade chips fit very nicely to explain what is happening to the outer panels. Regarding the explosives, please allow me to say a few words on that. We do not know what the exact chemical nature of the explosives were, and because there's been some confusion here. Fact is that the research I told you about, which started in the early 90s, is also aimed at applying nanotechnology in development of modern explosives. And this is where the polymer comes in, because you can add chemicals and use special polymers for this matrix I told you about, which, what should I say, redirects the energy of the thermite reaction, making the substance an explosive. The point here is, to be an explosive, the chemical reaction must develop a gas very fast, very, very fast. Explosives are not particularly energetic. This is a mistake. The point is that the chemical reaction in an explosive is fast, so that the gas released exercise a very high pressure on the surroundings, so you knock things over. The old-time thermite was an incendiary, meaning that it is destroying things by means of heat. Now, the modern development, when you go into the nanotechnology area, these two basic principles, you can say, about destroying things are merging. So maybe, I don't know, maybe the explosives were based on nanothermitic materials. We don't know. Maybe they were what I call molecular explosives. Other people would call them conventional explosives. Could be. It has never been investigated. NIST refused to look for explosives. And I fear that any traces of, if there have been what we call conventional explosives being used, they may have evaporated, because they do so over time.
Okay, I have two questions. I need short answers because my next guest, I want to get in here as well.
Yeah.
How long do you think it would take to apply these materials, and also could they be detonated from a distance?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but sure, of course, it takes time. This is a gigantic enterprise from an engineering point of view. It takes a long time. I would advise the interested listener to look up. Kevin Ryan has published 4 essays with the collective title called Access to the Towers, because this is the key point: who had access to the towers. In particular, the elevator shafts is really how you should get in, and there was renovation programs. People have been thinking about that. The next question was about, could they be detonated from, of course, you know, wireless detonation is used routinely in the demolition business. You don't need cables.
Okay, please hold your thought. Professor Niels Herrett, professor in chemistry, Department of Chemistry Department, University of Copenhagen. We're speaking to him from Copenhagen, Denmark. We're now going to go over to San Diego, California, and say hello to Commander R.E. Ted Moga. Nice to have you with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ted is a retired commander and a naval aviator for the U.S. Navy and a retired Pan Am pilot. He also received an education in civil engineering science, which sparked his questioning the official story about the pancake theory of free fall of the collapse of the towers. Commander Moga is also a member of the commissioned and non-commissioned officers for 9/11 Truth. Would you tell us, from your perspective as a pilot, the concerns you had, and take us step by step through what you saw in the official report that you felt could not align itself with your experience as a pilot and what you later would investigate and observe?
Okay. My first thoughts into the events of 9/11 actually were from an engineering point of view. I was always very, very curious as to how those buildings could have come down, and primarily coming down in such a symmetrical manner. That is the key. Buildings cannot come down symmetrically unless they're under absolute control. I don't care how you bring them down. The only possibility of a building like that, if a plane had run into maybe a 4-story wooden building, it's possible that would have collapsed. But we're talking about a 110-story steel building, and there is no way you're going to have three buildings, not just one building, but three buildings fail symmetrically, the probability of that is so low that it's not even imaginable. Now, from a standpoint of my experience as a pilot, I have to start off with the initial government story of the hijacking. I've always been concerned about that term. A more appropriate term would have been commandeered. The planes were commandeered. They took control of the airplanes. They didn't just hijack them, as we usually use the term. To hijack an airplane, you're going to have to disable the pilot somehow or another, either convince them to get out of their seats and go to the back of the airplane.
Please continue.
The concept of commandeering an airplane is you have to get the pilots out of the seat or disable them some way or the other. Now, it's very, very possible, and this is a possibility, that one of the pilots was a real wuss. He was a real timid pilot, and he would scare easy, and a threat in the cockpit could possibly get him out of there. In my experience in military and commercial flying, I have never met or come across a pilot that would have been that timid or that much of a wuss, if you can say that. And the probability of that goes down even lower when you have to keep in mind that there are two pilots. The only thing a pilot has to do when there is a threat in the cockpit is to grab the yoke and give it a sharp, abrupt movement. At that point, any threat in the cockpit would be neutralized unless they are strapped and secure in their seats. They would it would break a neck or a spine. Any threat in the cockpit would be neutralized by a pilot. Now, if one pilot was timid enough to want to leave, fortunately, there are two pilots up there, and you can rest assured that that second pilot would have grabbed that yoke. And to look at the degree of probability how low it can get, we have a second airplane with a third and fourth pilot, and then a third and fourth aircraft. You're talking about having eight pilots gathered on the East Coast of the morning of 9/11, and they just happen to have been scheduled to fly those particular airplanes. The degree of probability of that is so close to zero, it is zero. Those planes were not commandeered. Something else happened. We're not sure. Another anomaly of the flights was the failure of any of the eight pilots to insert the hijack code into their transponder. It takes just a second, a flip of the wrist on the center panel, and they would be able to notify the control agency that... Control agent room.
I need your undivided attention.
Okay.
You seem to be distracted.
No, that was something else on the phone just then.
Okay, but we have a clear channel. Please continue.
Okay. The transponder takes just a slight switch of the wrist to enter the hijack code. Either pilot can put it in. And to imagine that all eight pilots were derelict in this duty is beyond imagination. So these anomalies are just more than from an aviation point of view. It's highly, highly improbable that this government story could have been carried out the way they described it. As far as the clear evidence, the primary one that I look at, of course, is the Pentagon and also Shanksville. The government story of a 757 going into the Pentagon is just so much BS, I just cannot believe it. There is no evidence whatsoever, no empirical evidence, that a large aircraft caused the damage that we are able to see from all of the photos. And from those points of view, I don't see how anyone can support the government story. I mean, I know a lot of pilots, and there's not a one of them that I know of that would stand up and support the government story.
I'm sure you've spoken with many pilots, and having been a former commander in the Navy, that you would have had a chance to get a more accurate perspective. What has been the feedback from other pilots?
Actually, one of the websites, Pilots for 9/11 Truth, and also Patriots Question 9/11, they have literally hundreds of people with aviation background, and they will all, without exception, will tell you that the analysis that the folks from Pilots for 9/11 Truth that have provided from the data that they have been able to receive is just absolute proof that there is no way that the government story could have been carried out the way it was described. Here in San Diego, our organization here in San Diego, San Diegans for 9/11 Truth, we have a very successful organization down here. We have one event once a month and an outreach program, and we are reaching literally hundreds of people every month. And surprisingly, one of our most popular events that we have on our during our monthly meetings is entitled Aeronautical Improbabilities, and we go in strictly into the aspects of aviation and the improbability of those, especially the aircraft going into the Pentagon and also the one going into Shanksville.
Now, is it unusual from your experience that a plane, both in Pennsylvania and at the Pentagon, would be so completely vaporized that there be no evidence, forensic evidence at all left from either crash site?
I can't imagine vaporized. And once again, that was one of the first stories that came out that was leaked through the press and everything, that the, especially at the Pentagon, they said it vaporized. That's why there was no evidence of any aircraft parts there. They changed that story shortly thereafter, after I guess people were laughing so hard at it they just couldn't handle that. And so I think it was Popular Mechanics that came out and they changed the story to it liquefied, and so that it could go through the building and everything. And then finally, when that didn't have any legs, the official story simply stated that the plane disappeared and let the story lie there, and hopefully we're hoping the public just wouldn't bring up the subject anymore.
Well, we have seen hundreds of airplane disasters throughout the world where there's always wreckage. There are bodies out of the plane, there are bodies in the seats burned. There's always the fuselage. There's lots of parts of a plane, no matter what altitude it goes into, no matter if it goes into the ocean, we'll pick it up off the bottom of the ocean floor. But these incidents, there was nothing left. What is the likelihood of that being within the laws of aeronautical physics?
The probability of that, they don't even exist anymore. In other words, at the Pentagon, where you have a finite location of where the alleged crash was supposed to be, there is no doubt you would find two large titanium composite engines that you just literally cannot destroy to begin with. You would have a massive landing gear assembly, which is some of the highest grade steel that can be made, because that landing gear is holding up that airplane at every landing that it goes through. Not to mention all of the luggage, all of the seats, all of the carpet, it would be strung all over the place, and that isn't even mentioning bodies. So the likelihood of the government story of a 757 going there just doesn't hold any water at all. I cannot even imagine anyone even getting close to accepting that story. Shanksville is just as crazy, I guess. The first responders, the first police chief, I guess, and a few of the others that were coroners and people that were there, they said that there was no evidence of an airplane at all. And of course, those particular videos were only shown one day and never shown a second day.
Well, would it not also be reasonable to question that if a large airplane went into the building, the parts that could not go into the building, the wings, because it's a relatively small hole that was penetrated into the different quarters of the Pentagon, the wings would not have vaporized, because had they evaporized, then everything that they touched would have vaporized and liquefied, which meant that the building itself would have vaporized. You would have had everyone vaporizing and everyone liquefying along with that. But you had papers, eyewitnesses, saying they walked immediately out that hole where the ground did not burn their feet. There was papers all over the place. How could you have thousands and thousands of pieces of paper from the Pentagon and materials, wooden materials, desks and lockers from the Pentagon, and yet have nothing from the plane itself, which would have been far more difficult to combust? I don't understand that. Could you explain that to me?
Actually, I can't explain it except to explain it by saying that the story of a 757 flying into the Pentagon or crashing into the Pentagon just doesn't hold water. For all that jet fuel that would be burning at that point, there is no way anyone would be walking out of there for quite a while. Vaporizing an airplane, you're talking about high temperatures that even that temperatures that no one could survive in within the near vicinity. The angle, supposedly, that the hole that you could see on the videos would imply, if you're talking about a plane, the engine pods would have been pretty much on the ground. They would have been skidding in. If you look at the photos of the lawn in front of the Pentagon, I've never seen such pristine pictures in my life. Nothing came across that lawn. And
do you know any pilot that could have flown the plane in the trajectory that it had into the Pentagon without touching the ground?
Yeah, that particular analysis from the data that pilots from 9/11 Truth got, it would be a very, very difficult maneuver. Normally, if you were going to fly that maneuver, you would practice it in the simulator a few times, and then in addition to that, it would just take a very qualified and talented pilot to fly it in there. To imagine that an amateur or very inexperienced pilots being able to fly that just doesn't hold any water at all. The story is it just gets more ludicrous as you go into the details. And how it's just mind-boggling to me how the public can accept it. Except I am well aware that the psychological trauma that people go through, or that they would go through if in fact they accepted the government story for what it is. It's just too much for too many people. It would turn the world upside down. I sort of feel the same way to a certain degree, to think that elements or individuals within our own government would do this to us.
Yeah, but keep in mind, if this was several agencies of the government knowing the truth in advance, that we have hard evidence for. That's forensically proven. We have had people come forward who knew about the events 9/11, knew about the hijackers, actually had a secret cell into the group, so we knew who they were, we knew where they were staying, we knew what their plans were. Other intelligence agencies knew the same. Now, it's one thing to say we knew in advance, but there was breakdown in communication. We know that that's not the case. But then you have two scenarios. One is that there were a group of individuals, very powerful individuals, much like the people who would have to be at the head of the intelligence agencies, the national security agencies, the White House, the Pentagon. You couldn't have had this done by any rogue group. They would have been discovered. They would have been court-martialed or brought to crimes against humanity long ago, sedition. But instead, what if you then said, all right, if they're going to do this, and if we want a very good justification for creating an entirely new position in the Middle East, we'll go ahead and we'll have redundant plans. So the front group will be the hijackers. We will handle to make sure that there's no way that this isn't a monumental event. Who could have done it? What would have been the means? What would have been the technology, the scientists, all the technicians to have implemented this, the people to have covered it up? You would have had to have had hundreds of individuals involved if indeed this was a false flag operation. All I'm doing at this point is I'm raising questions about the official investigation, and they leave us no choice but to continue to challenge their position, including, as you and many other pilots have done, on the planes did this, the pilots who were trained didn't punch in the code, the pilots didn't try to throw the plane, which they all know how to do, into a particular maneuver which would have broken the backs or necks, as you said, of the people involved. there's just too many inconsistencies, and at a certain point when you have a preponderance of misinformation, a preponderance of information that was not allowed into, and much of the information allowed was not under oath, and much of the information that was given was then later excluded, including Mr. Gonzalez, who heard multiple explosions 8 seconds before the plane hit the tower, blew him up in the air, blew another person who was a longtime friend of his clear across the wall, first responders hearing these explosions, hearing them throughout this, and yet this was prior to the major planes hitting by seconds. This then begs the issue of demanding a new independent investigation, bringing other people from all different expertise in, including yourself and other pilots. Final thought from you.
Yeah, actually, as far as the 9/11 Commission, it was not an investigation. It was basically a very elaborate cover-up. It was all designed. They had all the information out there. They knew they controlled the mass media, the corporate media. The stories, a few stories accidentally leaked out that they had to cover up or failed to show again. But basically, the biggest part of their planning, in addition to all of the planes, the destructions of all the buildings, was the cover-up. That was the biggest plan, and they had to be absolutely sure that they were able to cover it up. There has been no evidence recovered whatsoever to identify any commercial aircraft, any of the two United or the two American Airlines. There have been no components of the airplanes that have been physically identified through serial numbers, and they do that every time there is an aircraft investigation. It's the first thing they do. This is their empirical evidence. This is how they carry out an investigation. And I know that one, General Stubblebine, which is an expert in imagery investigating in accidents and everything, he will tell you right now in his own mind that there is no evidence whatsoever that a commercial aircraft flew into the Pentagon. And, of course, that would apply to Shanksville as well. And as far as the two towers, I still have not come across any evidence provided by the government that would identify the two airplanes as being the commercial airplanes that they wrote up in their story.
We're out of time for this segment. Thank you very much. My guest, Commander Ted Muga, M-U-G-A. He is a retired commander, a naval aviator for the United States Navy, and as well as a retired Pan Am World Airways pilot. He also has a background, educational background in civil engineering science, and he is part of hundreds of pilots who now question the 9/11 official panel. Also, thank you very much for the other guest, Professor Neil Herrett. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. In this segment of our program, I'm going to share the thoughts of Russ Baker, whowhatwhy.com. The article is entitled, Is the Saudi Royal Family Connected to the 9/11 Hijackers? Now, for those of you who don't know, Who, What, and Why has found evidence that for the first time shows a definite link to the royal Saudi family. To Saudis in South Florida who reportedly had direct contact with the 9/11 hijackers before fleeing the United States just prior to the attacks. Our report connects some of the dots first laid out by investigative author Anthony Summers and Florida-based journalist Dan Christensen in articles jointly published in the Miami Herald on the nonprofit website BrowardBulldog.org. Now, in early September of this year, Summers and Christensen reported that a secret FBI probe never shared with congressional investigators or the Presidential 9/11 Commission had uncovered information indicating the possibility of support for the hijackers from previously unknown Confederates in the United States during 2001. Now we can reveal that those alleged Confederates were closely tied to influential members of the Saudi ruling elite. As reported in the Herald, phone records documented communications dating back more than a year that connected a Saudi family then living in a house near Sarasota, Florida, with the alleged plot leader, Mohammed Atta, and his hijacked pilots, as well as to 11 of the other hijackers. In addition, records from the guardhouse at the gated community tied Atta's vehicle and his accomplice to actual visits to the house. Now, though requiring further investigation, this information suggests that the house may have functioned as an operational base for the hijackers. According to interviews and records examined, they now have proof that that there was an abrupt departure from this house in Sarasota only a few days before the 9/11, 2001, the catastrophe at 9/11. And these individuals then traveled to Arlington, Virginia, where they stayed briefly at another house owned by Anand's father, Goswali. Then, still well before 9/11, the entire group, now including the father, flew to London and on to Saudi Arabia. The Sarasota house was sold in 2003, as was a penthouse apartment in another D.C. suburb, Roslyn, Virginia. They did not seem to have set foot in the United States again after they fled. Now, there's lots of new revelations, and again, this, for my audience, is really important. Building on these revelations, documentation that lays out that the Ghazalis, who were in the Sarasota house, who owned that house, had royal connections through a nest of Saudi corporations that share the name IRAD, E-I-R-A-D. Ezem Ghazawi is director of IRAD Management Company, the UK division of IRAD Trading and Contracting Company Limited, which, among other things, holds the Saudi franchise for many multinational brands, including UPS. Ezem's brother, Mamdo, whose name shows up on public records associated with family properties in the United States, is executive managing director of the parent firm, IRAD Holding Company Limited. The IRAD has connections to the U.S. government through contracts. In 2008, records show the State Department paid them $11,733 for rental facilities, presumably in Saudi Arabia. There is no indication that the company itself or any of its officers or employees have any connection to the 9/11 incident or knowledge of anything regarding Mr. Ghazawi's activities in the United States. And calls for comment to the company's main switchboard went unanswered during normal business hours. But the now revealed link between Ghazawi's and the highest ranks of Saudi establishment, including the royal family, reopens questions about the White House's controversial approval of multiple charter flights allowing Saudi nationals to depart the United States beginning about 48 hours after the attacks, without the passengers being interviewed by law enforcement, despite the identification of the majority of the hijackers as being Saudi. In addition, the new revelations draw further attention to a web of relationships that include the long and close business, personal, and political ties between the Bush family and the Saudi royal family. Saudi money is woven throughout the business ventures connected to the Bushes. Saudi funds even helped bail out George Bush's failing oil company early in his life. Jim Bath, a close friend of Bush and Texas Air National Guard, went on to start a business in conjunction with two sons of powerful Saudi families, whose the family provides banking services to the Saudi royals. And one is Salam bin Laden, heir to the bin Laden family's global construction empire, and half-brother to Osama bin Laden. Now, the Ghazawi presence in the Sunshine State predated 9/11 by at least 6 years. In 1995, a young Saudi woman named Anand Ghazawi, living in southern Florida, married a fellow Saudi native. And Anad's father, Isam, and his American-born wife, Deborah, bought the couple a stylish three-bedroom house in a gated community in Sarasota. The house remained in the elder Ghazawi's names while the young couple lived there and began a family. 6 years later, and here's what's important, less than 2 weeks before the 9/11 attacks, Anad Ghazawi and their children left their home on or about August 30, 2001, in great haste, taking off in a white van. This was about the same time the hijackers were purchasing their tickets for the targeted flights. The family apparently left with no advance planning, leaving behind all their possessions. They abandoned three recently registered vehicles, including a brand new Chrysler PT Cruiser, in the garage and driveway. Now, quote, this is from the official investigation. There was mail on the table, dirty diapers in one of the bathrooms, all the toiletries still in place, all their clothes hanging in the closet. Opulent furniture, equal or greater in value than the house itself, was still there. The pool running with toys in it. The beds were made. Fruit on the counter. The refrigerator full of food. It was like they went grocery shopping, like they went out to a movie. But the safe was open in the master bedroom, and nothing was in it. Not a paperclip. A computer was still there. A computer plug in another room, and the line still there. Looked like they had taken another computer and left the cord. Unquote. After public disclosure of Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks, people in the gated community took note of the rushed departure and disappearance of the family. After all, the attackers were not just overwhelmingly of Saudi nationality, but three out of the four of the future hijackers had lived and trained to fly in Venice, Florida, just 10 miles from this house. The complex security officer alerted the FBI, which began an investigation into the house at 4224 Escondido Circle. The Justice Department declined to make a statement, but according to an unnamed senior counterterrorism officer who was one of the two people who got into the house first and served as a key source on the investigation bore stunning fruit. Phone records showed, and this is important, this is very, very significant information. The phone records show communication dating back more than a year that connected those in the house with the alleged plot leader, Mohammed Atta, and his accomplices, including 11 of the other hijackers. Other records kept by guards of the gated community documented numerous visits to the house by a vehicle known to have been used by Atta and indicated the physical presence in the car of Atta's purported accomplice, Jara. It appeared as if the Ghazawi house was some kind of nerve center for the entire operation. Now, according to the senior counterterrorism officer, both Essam Ghazawi and his son-in-law, Al-Hajiya, had been on a watch list of the FBI predating 9/11. An unnamed U.S. agency tracking terror funds had also taken an interest in them. Quote, 464 was Ghazawi's number, the officer said. I don't remember the other man's number. Those stunning revelations, said to be based on the work of a swarm of FBI agents who descended on the gated community in the fall of 2001, would surely have generated headlines worldwide if they had become known after 9/11. But the FBI, for reasons unknown, failed to provide the information to congressional 9/11 investigators or to the Presidential 9/11 Commission, and thus it has remained a secret for the past decade until you're hearing it today and the Herald breaking the story. In response to the Herald article, the FBI had issued a statement saying that the occupants of the house had been tracked down and interrogated and were found to have no connections to the hijackers. It is not clear when these interrogations are supposed to have taken place or whether they were conducted by the FBI or by the Saudi intelligence. But given the FBI's poor track record for candor in the matter, the statement is being viewed with skepticism. Adding to these doubts is an ineffective effort by the Bureau to woe the house owners back to Florida. According to Scott McKay, a lawyer for Homeowners Association for the Gated Community, the FBI attempted to convince the Gazawis they needed to come back in person to sign documents related to unpaid back dues to the association. This attempt proved unsuccessful when the Gazawis simply arranged to sign the documents elsewhere. These facts raise questions about the U.S. government's determination to interview the couple. Gazawi's signature was notarized in Lebanon by a U.S. official, no less, the vice counsel for the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. His wife's signature was also notarized elsewhere in the United States in Riverside County, California. The emergence of this information chagrined Bob Graham, the former U.S. Senator. Graham was Senate Intelligence Committee Chair and a 2004 candidate for Democratic presidential nomination and served as co-chair of the Congressional Joint Inquiry into 9/11. Quote, at the beginning of the investigation, each of the intelligence agencies, including the FBI, was asked to provide all information that agency possessed in relation to 9/11. Unquote. Graham noted that the Bureau also failed to turn over information connecting the hijackers to other Saudis living in California, which his own investigators later discovered on their own. Just as strange, when Graham's congressional investigators turned over a large body of information on the hijackers they had assembled to the Presidential 9/11 Commission, it seemed uninterested. Quote, they did very little with it, Graham said, and their reference to Saudi Arabia is almost cryptic sometimes. I never got a good answer as to why they did not pursue them, unquote. Now, about the new discovery in Sarasota, Graham said this. It opens the door to a new chapter of the investigation as to the depth of the Saudi role in 9/11. All eyes on Prince Sultan. Of special interest is the Gazawi's boss, the chairman of Irad Holding Company, Prince Sultan bin Salam bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud. He is a prominent and powerful member of the royal Saudi royal family who is expected to become crown prince and therefore in line to become king of Saudi Arabia. Born in 1956, which makes him approximately the same age as the Gazawi brothers, Prince Sultan is a grandson of King Abdul Aziz, commonly referred to as Ibn Saud, founder of modern Saudi Arabia. Prince Sultan's family is of enormous importance in today's Saudi Arabia. His father, Prince Salman, has been the governor of the province of the royal city since 1962 and is considered an arbitrator among the frequently warring members of the Saudi royal family, with its 4,000 princes. Salman is the second youngest of the so-called Seven, an extremely powerful alliance of full brothers jockeying for power in the country. A leading advocate of teaching Saudis to fly, Prince Sultan is the founder and chairman of the board of the Saudi Aviation Club and the chairman of the King Khalil International Airport. In a document released by WikiLeaks, the U.S. ambassador in Saudi Arabia, James Smith, characterized Prince Sultan in this way, quote, with a powerful father who is the governor of the capital and a strong candidate to be the next crown prince, Sultan is well positioned to move up the Saudi government ranks. Sultan has visited almost every state in the United States. He joked with the ambassador that perhaps the only states he has not yet visited are the Dakotas. Prince Sultan is closely aligned with Prince Bandar bin Sultan bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, the former longtime ambassador to the United States, who is often called Bandar Bush for his friendly relationship with the Bush family. Sultan and Bandar have worked together for years to promote Saudi interests in aviation. Now, the Bush family have long been regarded as friendly with the prince's family and their associates. Prince Sultan's NASA mission is perceived as having been orchestrated by George Bush as a favor to the Saudis. Associates of the Bush family have many connections with Prince's family. Prince Sultan's father's legal counsel was William Jeffress of Houston-based Baker Botts LLP, where James Baker III, longtime advisor to the Bush family, including both President Bush, is a senior partner. At the time of the 9/11 attacks, Baker held the post of senior counselor for the Carlyle Group a global asset management firm which is heavily invested in military contracting stocks. Among them, Carlyle's large investments were the Bin Ladens. In a curious coincidence, Baker watched the live television coverage of the attacks from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, where he and representatives of Osama bin Laden's extended family were attending the Carlyle Group's annual conference. In another odd coincidence, President Bush himself was in Sarasota, reading to children at the very time the Sarasota area-based terrorists were hijacking the planes. Indeed, he was a short distance from the home of the Ghazouis that they had recently abandoned. President Bush's actions in the aftermath of the World Trade Center and Pentagon assaults with regard to the Saudi royal family have long been known, but have yet to be fully explored. Shortly after the attacks, President Bush permitted an exception to the ban on air traffic so that planes could take prominent Saudis out of the country. One of those leaving on the flights was the late Prince Ahmad bin Salman, brother to Prince Sultan. In a 2004 letter to the New York Times, Prince Sultan responded to allegations surrounding those flights and pointed to a conclusion in the 9/11 Commission report, quote, "Our own independent review of the Saudi nationals involved confirms that no one with known links to the terrorism people departed on those flights." Now, Sultan's brother, Prince Ahmad, was the most westernized the Saudi set. He raced racehorses in Kentucky, was the owner of the 2001 Kentucky Derby winner with perhaps an unfortunate name, War Emblem. Allegations concerning him emerged in a book, Why America Slept, by the best-selling author Gerald Posner. Posner says that intelligence sources told him how in March 2002, under interrogation, but before he was waterboarded 83 times in August, Al-Qaeda's purported chief of operations relaxed and began cooperating. Tricked into thinking he was in Saudi custody, he asked his interrogators to call a senior member of the Saudi royal family, who he said was in his contact. He provided from memory the man's private home and cell numbers. This contact, according to Posner, was Prince Ahmad. Now, this is alleged to have he is alleged to have said that Osama bin Laden had cut a deal with the top Pakistani military official, Air Marshal Mushaf al-Mir, who was close to Islamic elements in Pakistan intelligence. According to this account, Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki signed off on this and agreed to provide aid to the Taliban in Afghanistan and not to go after al-Qaeda so long as the terrorist group kept its gun sights trained away from the Saudi royals. In this version of events, he is said to have also implicated Prince Sultan, along with another cousin, Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saadi al-Kabir, as al-Qaeda backers, and to have claimed that the Pakistani Air Marshal, Mushaf Ali Mir, and Saudi Prince Ahmad knew in advance about the 9/11 attacks. Though the interrogators were skeptical of these claims, the terrorist who was being waterboarded often provided credible information. He provided information that led to the capture of a senior al-Qaeda operative in Southeast Asia. He would only talk when he thought he was in Saudi hands. When U.S. personnel, no longer posing as Saudis, confronted him, he said he had made up his earlier statements, but investigators found no basis for believing the information to be false and even found material that corroborated his claimed ties to high-level Saudis. Not surprisingly, the Saudi and Pakistani governments insisted his claims were false in all respects. Now, one of the key figures named by the waterboarder, Prince Turki, had been removed from his position as Saudi intelligence chief in September 1, 2001, 10 days before the attacks. Thus, he was apparently not in that post on the critical day. Yet his removal was a temporary absence from the highest levels of Saudi leadership and not necessarily an indication that he had fallen into serious disfavor. The next year, he was named Saudi ambassador to Great Britain, just as a shift in focus from al-Qaeda Iraq was being pitched to the British. If the al-Qaeda claims are at all credible, the removal of Turki from his official position shortly before the attacks surely warranted additional analysis. as does the Gazawi's hasty flight from the United States right in the same time frame. Now, according to the book The 11th Day by Summers and his co-author Robin Swan, Zubaydah is not alone in asserting a Saudi Arabia deal. Quote, in sworn statements after 9/11, former Taliban intelligence chief said that in 1998, Prince Turki, chief of Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Department, sealed a deal under which bin Laden agreed not to attack Saudi targets. In return, Saudi Arabia would provide funds and material assistance to the Taliban, not demand bin Laden's extradition, and not bring pressure to close down al-Qaeda training camps. Saudi businesses, meanwhile, would ensure that money also flowed directly to bin Laden. Unquote. Well, Prince Ahmed and another royal, Prince Sultan, were among the 15 Saudis spirited out of the U.S. with President Bush's approval on September 16, 2001, via Lexington, Kentucky, and out of Prince Ahmad's U.S. backyard. Prince Sultan bin Fahd is the nephew of Prince Ahmed and Prince Sultan, and the son of Prince Salman, who died unexpectedly shortly before 9/11 attacks. Quote, it appears as if they didn't want to be around to be questioned as to what role they had played, and the best way to avoid that was to get out of the country, unquote. And Senator Bob Graham, speaking with the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Now, there has been a long-time relationship between the Gazawis, who fled from Sarasota, whose home is now looked upon as the catalyst meeting place for the terrorist, and his relationship with the United States. It goes back to the 1950s when U.S. immigration records showed that he visited New York, and also he was a prominent Saudi attorney, and then they arrived on a first-class ticket on a connecting flight that originated in Saudi Arabia, and they traveled with an entire entourage. So this was not a low-level, insignificant person that owned the house that had all these business dealings. He was a very high-connected Saudi person. So this simply raises a lot of questions about new evidence. This is important because it shows that the FBI withheld this evidence from the Presidential Commission and from any investigators. How could something this significant have stayed secret for so long, only with the full cooperation of those in positions of power? Because the moment you bring in the Saudi royal family and all the princes who are major spokespersons for the Saudi family and business interest, you would then cast aspersions. That could impact our trading, and the largest trader that we have for the United States in weapons is Saudi Arabia. They recently signed a deal higher than $40 billion for arms and security systems. So now we must put energy and focus upon this connection and be honest with ourselves. At the heart of the original plot, the Saudis were clearly implicated by all of these extenuating circumstances. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. To continue our discussion on the 9/11 special, we're going to go to Germany now. We're standing by is Annie Machon. Annie Machon is a former intelligence officer for M15, the UK Security Service, who was posted to the M15's political and counterterrorism departments. She resigned in 1996 to blow the whistle on the spies' incompetence and crimes with her ex-partner, David Shiler. As a journalist and author, Annie is also a recognized international public speaker on a variety of issues, including security and intelligence, the war on terror, and media and press freedoms, secrecy legislation, civil liberties, totalitarianism, police states, and accountability in government and business. She is the author of the book Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, M15 in the David Shiler Affair. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
As I have spoken at the beginning of the program, and as I will reiterate again, one of the issues that we face, we meaning those of us who try to bring information to the public's attention, is to separate out what we are doing and the information we are presenting from what the mainstream or official media would like to believe are nothing more than conspiracy theories. This is a slur that they have used repeatedly. And as a result, the moment you suggest that there is some part, no matter how insignificant, to the official version that is inaccurate, they immediately say, well, that's just a unproven conspiracy theory. And as a result, the conspiracy theory slur closes down people who want to believe in authority. This goes along with the straw man argument. They propose a crazy theory and then suggest that this is what all 9/11 skeptics think. And as we do not get a chance to respond to this works quite well and explain why they keep us off the airwaves, it also explains why they choose the most radical and controversial people to represent us. Well, they don't represent us. So just so the people in this audience know who've just tuned in, before allowing any of the guests to appear, our standard for presenting information on this program is that it must meet a forensic acid test, meaning if you could not hold your position in a court of law under cross-examination and forensic examination, then it doesn't appear on this program. Hence, only highly qualified information that can withstand any form of scrutiny is involved in this discussion. And that separates us, what we're doing, from so many of the other programs. That said, what I'd like for you to do, Annie, and I will not interrupt you on this because we have meticulously gone over your work, I would like for you to go through your research, your background on what you see as the weaknesses in the official 9/11 report, and take us through each one of the ways that you deconstruct the arguments, because it's in the deconstruction of the arguments that we make our first effort to find the truth. We have to find what is not true in the official report before we can then put forward evidence of what may be the truth. So the forum is yours. Take your time and start the process of taking us through the errors, omissions, cover-ups, out-and-out lies, or perjured testimony that you see in this, and the failings of the media to do the work that you and others have done.
Okay, well, it's interesting you say that you require a forensic level of understanding and also proof, because, of course, having been a whistleblower from MI5, from the British intelligence community, I have indeed had to go into the stand and give forensic evidence in the past. So I do know the sort of standards required. I suppose the best way to approach this is really a little bit of introduction to my background, because that has given me a very detailed understanding of the concept of what has now become known as false flag terrorism, where you have a terrorist atrocity occurring and then it being blamed on one group but actually carried out by a separate group for their political or economic or whatever advantage. So in terms of what I helped to blow the whistle on, there were two cases, two very clear cases. One was in 1994 when there was a bomb exploded outside the Israeli embassy in London and some innocent Palestinian students were rounded up, and two of them were charged with conspiracy to cause the explosion, were convicted and were sentenced to 20 years each. And they've always proclaimed their innocence. And in fact, MI5, which is the sort of domestic intelligence gathering agency in the UK, knew that they were innocent because the senior investigating officer in MI5, who'd seen not only all the evidence for the court, but also all the background intelligence, he made the assessment that the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, had actually carried out a controlled explosion outside their own embassy. Now, it's, again, it would probably be dismissed as conspiracy theory, but this was the official MI5 position. And he said that it had been done probably for two reasons. One, to gain increased security around the Israeli interests in London, but then secondly to shatter a rapidly growing Palestinian political support network of which these two innocent Palestinians belonged. So that was one episode which happened in a couple of years before we left to blow the whistle. But the key one was the Gaddafi plot, as it became known, which is the case that made us quit, made us go public, blow the whistle, and end up going on the run and living in exile for 3 years in Europe. And in this case, we had MI6, which is a sort of James Bond foreign intelligence agency, a bit like the CIA, funding and helping a ragtag group of Islamic extremists in Libya to try and assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. And this was way back in 1996. Now, at this point, Gaddafi had given up terrorism. He had been a major terrorist backer for the first two decades, but he'd given it up by this point. So he was sort of coming in from the cold. But MI6 funded this group to try and assassinate him. And this assassination attempt was illegal under UK law because they didn't get the written permission of their political master, the Foreign Secretary. And this was also a highly reckless act in a very volatile part of the world, as we've seen over the last few months this year. And it was also, it led to the deaths of innocent bystanders who were killed in the ensuing security shootout. So you see something like this, you are officially briefed about this operation, which is MI6 is promulgating in 1995, 1996, where they're funding a group linked to Al-Qaeda at the time. And that meant that the intelligence agencies in Britain were funding and sponsoring an illegal terrorist attack in Libya to try and assassinate somebody, and they killed innocent people. So you get to a position where you see something like that, and you can't imagine a more heinous crime. It's certainly not something that you sign up to get involved in when you are recruited to work as a spook. So we left and we blew the whistle. I mean, as I said, we ended up going on the run around Europe and living in exile, and David Shaler went to prison twice for trying to expose murder on the part of MI6. MI6 has managed to get away with it to this day. There's never been a proper inquiry, even though, you know, post the NATO war in Libya this year, it has been fully acknowledged that, yes, there was this assassination attempt in 1996, and yes, some of the people, the rebels that have been backed by the West, are the same players as they were in 1996. So it's a huge mess. So I think just from that was my sort of personal experience of what can go on in the background. And that led me to look at other aspects of media manipulation, intelligence manipulation, government lies. And, of course, that takes you inexorably into the wider aspects of what could potentially be false flag attacks. I mean, it's a perfectly standard approach that spies and intelligence agencies use across the world. The Russians used it when they bombed some apartment blocks in Moscow in 1999, and that was the KGB doing that, and that gave them a pretext to invade Chechnya. We've seen it again and again in the Northern Irish War, where a false flag was used. And in fact, even last week, there was a WikiLeaks cable that released a document saying that the Ethiopian government had bombed its own people in 2006 and blamed it on Eritrean rebels. So, you know, this goes on across the planet. It's perfectly standard. So once you accept that as a sort of historic reality, then you have to look at every major terrorist atrocity across the planet with that awareness that it could actually be something dodgy in the back of your mind when you're looking at the evidence, which then does lead you on to look at issues like 9/11, for example, where whatever the facts of the case are, the way it has been used, the way that it was immediately used as the pretext for the war on terror, it was immediately used as a pretext for the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And the Americans were in Afghanistan within a couple of months of 9/11 happening. And also where it's been used as a pretext because of the war on terror to shred all our democratic civil liberties in our own countries to protect us against these terrorists. It seems very convenient. So I certainly would urge everyone to look at a big attack like 9/11 with this sort of awareness in the back of their mind.
All right, I appreciate that overview. So just let me summarize this for our audience. And by the way, my guest, Annie Michon, is speaking from Germany. We don't have the best technical connection, so if there's a point where I have to reiterate some of the stuff, I will. What she is suggesting, as having been an integral part of M15, the domestic spying intelligence gathering part, much like our FBI, in England for a long period of time, and then seeing corruption, seeing the government actually engaged in lies, deception. She then blew the whistle with a colleague, and then they had to go on the run. And we'll ask her why she went on the run in a moment. But the truth finally came out, but it didn't matter the truth finally came out. By the way, just this week, just 3 days ago, England for the first time stated they would compensate financially those who were killed in the Bloody Sunday, which was a notorious episode in English history against the Irish, where that also was engaged with dirty tricks. And all these decades, they have denied complicity. Now they're acknowledging it and compensating, but look at how long it took for the truth to come out. What she is suggesting is that in the Sudan, in England, and other parts around the world, especially with the United States and Britain working to undermine Gaddafi after he had stopped his terrorist activity, to kill him, overthrow his government, the people that they put in place to do this were the very same people who are in place today, same characters, different time. And then we have to ask, what would be their motives? Well, water for the French, oil, of course, and arms, reconstruction. Everyone's got a piece of that pie. That's the motive. But the means to do it, they have had. Then we have to look at how many false flags have we had. A false flag, by the way, is where you actually do something and then blame it on someone else who becomes demonized. Then it gives you the just moral justification to attack them. For example, weapons of mass destruction. They were not suggesting there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They were out and out unequivocally stating. Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and by the way, many of the very same people, Dick Cheney, and Wolfowitz, who had come from previous administrations and who had been engaged in false flags before, for example, in Vietnam. You forget, go back and look at who was in power during the Vietnam War, and you'll see Donald Rumsfeld, and you'll see Dick Cheney, and then you'll see the spy master behind them all, a man named Colson. And Colson was a station chief of the CIA for a number of years and been involved in Vietnam since 1954, and before he became head of the CIA. And it was under him, not Cabot Lodge, who was the ambassador. It was he who gave the instructions and his CIA operative stations assistants to the White House, the Kennedy White House. The Diem brothers had to go, the two brothers running Vietnam, South Vietnam at that time. They then plotted the coup. You don't go, by the way, this was what got us officially into Vietnam. We had 16,000 advisors in Vietnam at the time. From there, we went to a full-blown war. But what really got us officially into the Vietnam War? A false flag operation. There is no questioning history now because the documents have been released under Freedom of Information and scholars have examined them. The Gulf of Tonkin attack, meaning where North Vietnam, under Ho Chi Minh, attacked ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, and that's what precipitated our getting into the war. There was no attack against American ships. That has been proven. That was a false flag, but it was good enough to get us in there. And the assassination of the Diem brothers and by Colson, and all the people around him at the time, who were the people involved with Kennedy? Who were the people behind the scene? Who were the neocons? The very same people who were behind George Bush, behind the going into Iraq. Were they held accountable? No. Held accountable in Iraq? No. And who were the people who then justified 9/11 then to go into Afghanistan and to go into Iraq? Because remember, part of going into Iraq was Saddam Hussein was working with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Iraq had become a terrorist state, harboring Al-Qaeda, making weapons of mass destruction, and they used it against America. That's what convinced the public. And how did they do it? Judith Miller, the New York Times. How did she do it? There was a false flag operation security agency secretly working in the vice president's office, Dick Cheney, under his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and they came up with this real nut job, a complete nut job, and they called him Curveball. And Curveball already had been given a lie detector test. The main CIA operative said he was a false person, not to believe him. German intelligence, false person. Mossad, false person. But suddenly he became the only credible witness to get us into this war. So how they do it very cleverly. Cheney said, or Cheney's assistant, Scooter Libby, gave Judith Miller of the New York Times the contact. She interviewed him, and she did six articles drumming up for us to go to us to go into Iraq. And then Cheney said, well, see, even the New York Times telling us that you know, there's credible sources. It's circular. He created the false lead, then comes back and uses the false lead as if that's the justification. They did this in Vietnam. They did this in Grenada. They've done this in other situations. And some people, I am not going into it in this program, believe that Lockerbie was also a false flag operation. I can't prove that, but there's compelling evidence to deconstruct the official story. In any case, for those who are so cynical, they would never question that the government would do a false flag operation. There are many false flags, and I can take you back and show you. For example, who was the number one person, the most powerful person in the United States, that was used as our official source to go back into Iraq and run the government? A man named Chalabi. What could anybody have found out about Chalabi just by going up on any of the search engines? That he was a convicted felon. He was convicted in absentia in Jordan for embezzling $100 million of his own depositors' money and then fleeing the country. So on the one hand, we have irrefutable proof that the man heading the National Congress, the Iraqi National Congress, was a convicted felon, an arms dealer, a dirty background, and yet he was the one the neocons, Paul Wolfowitz and all the others, were parading through Washington, raising millions of dollars, and convincing the media that we have to go back into Iraq, and he would lead the new government, and he's the one that we gave the money to, the protection to, etc. I give you this only as background, because if you do not have this background, then it's incomprehensible that anybody would have had any participation in either knowingly covering up an advance warning of attack on 9/11, or in any way facilitating a participation in it as using the bombers attacking it, the radical Islamists out of Saudi Arabia. And that's another story to itself. How much did the Saudi Arabia family know about this, and what did they do in participating in it by financing these people? But there's a lot of evidence there. By the way, I congratulate the Miami Herald for breaking a wonderful, in-depth investigative reporting story about two people who have never come under the radar, who it can be shown the bombers were staying at their house, they had phone records, and that these people left just days before the 9/11 attack, left everything, left food in the refrigerator, their clothes, took nothing with them, but they got out of the country. And more on that on another segment. But now we're just putting the pieces together. And this is a forensic challenge to the official version. That said, is that an accurate overview of what you were discussing with us?
Absolutely. I mean, you raised a number of very interesting points, particularly Bloody Sunday. Which, of course, happened in the early 1970s, where British troops opened fire on innocent demonstrators in Northern Ireland and kicked off the next round of the Civil War. And it was interesting that 10 years ago, the media received leaks from the intelligence agencies saying that one of their sources, who was codenamed Infliction, claimed that Martin McGuinness, who, of course, is the Deputy Prime Minister in Northern Ireland, standing as president for the Republic of Ireland elections in the next couple of months, who had been a member of the IRA way back in the 70s, Infliction, the sword, claimed that Martin McGuinness fired the first shot. And it was only because both David Shiller and myself had seen information about him on the inside that we could go public and say, no, Infliction was known as someone who made up information. He was an unreliable source. And that was the only reason that evidence was overturned during the Bloody Sunday inquiry. So it's a very careful, very clever way of trying to spin the perception in the media of what happened on Bloody Sunday. Also, as well, I totally agree with the idea that false flag and dirty tricks happen. But it's interesting you mentioned Lockerbie, because Lockerbie is a case that David Shiller worked on in the mid-1990s, when all the PR was coming out of Libya to try and move blame away from them before they actually accepted they weren't guilty and, you know, paid up all the money and everything. So he had to go through all the evidence with a fine tooth comb. Now, I didn't do this, David Shaler did. But it's interesting that I know many, many, many mainstream journalists who are all convinced that Lockerbie is a conspiracy theory, that it's not the true case, we haven't got the true facts. But those very same journalists, even though they're suspicious of Lockerbie, will immediately point the finger at anyone who questions something like 9/11, for example. So one is a respectable conspiracy theory, the other one is an unrespected conspiracy theory. And I find that quite strange, that journalists can do that when there's a lot of information to support the official story on Lockerbie, but there's very little information to support the official story on 9/11. And it's interesting watching how the media does this as well, because having had a lot of experience trying to work with them over the years since the whistleblowing, I know how they can be stitched up. I mean, it's a sort of many-leveled operation that the government spin machine uses, that the intelligence agencies spin as well into the media, where you have these poor hacks trying to sort of run on a hamster wheel, trying to get the information out, churn the information out with very little time, no resources to properly investigate, where you also have picked agents of influence on those national media outlets, where you have people who are invited into the sort of secret circle, the charmed circle, where they get select briefings so they can write their select stories. But also as well, certainly in the UK and the US, we have a battery of laws that can be used against journalists if they try and investigate something and expose something that the powers that be don't want. So, for example, in the UK, they can be prosecuted for libel under the terrorism laws. There is a self-censorship, very senior committee called the Defence Press Advisory Committee that can slap a banning notice, a gagging notice on any story that the government deems to be unwelcome. And also, they can use the Official Secrets Act, which is a very draconian piece of legislation that means that if you blow the whistle from the intelligence agencies, you are criminalised. Doesn't matter if you're reporting murder, you are the criminal for going public about the information. But it also criminalises the journalists who report that information. And in fact, they tried to use the Official Secrets Act last week against a UK national newspaper, The Guardian, which has been exposing information about the News International Rupert Murdoch phone hacking scandal in the UK. And the police try to get heavy with the journalists to expose their sources because they keep coming up with these great stories about yet more bad things the Murdoch press have done. So it's interesting watching all these different levers controlling the media. But I think just one final point, the most malign part of the media control by the intelligence agencies certainly is their media manipulation departments. And in the UK, MI6 has a little section called Information Operations, or IOPS, which is used to plant fake stories in the media. And this happened in the 1990s, famously with, ironically, the son of Colonel Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam, who was libeled by a national newspaper with a fake story about money laundering. And he sued that newspaper because, of course, the MI5 whistleblower had said, this is just a lie, it's not a true story. But the point is, once they get that story in the press, it becomes fact, and other journalists then report it, and it goes into the sort of written history of what is true. And I think we see that a lot of times, certainly over issues, particularly like big terrorist attacks like 9/11, where certain myths are put out early on, and then they are just perpetuated because journalists don't have the time to investigate. They just regurgitate and copy what they read in other newspapers. So it's a very useful lever to use against the national media, our international media now, when covering these sort of issues.
I appreciate that overview. Annie, would you now go through and show us what you believe are completely legitimate challenges to the official version of 9/11?
I don't take a position on what might have happened with 9/11. I mean, I think there are so many professionals out there, both architects, academics, engineers, whistleblowers, intelligence experts, firefighters, pilots, everyone. All these different professional groups are out there on the internet, and they're all saying, this can't happen, this little bit doesn't stack up, this part doesn't stack up, the basic laws of physics don't stack up. But I prefer not to speculate. I prefer just to say, because we have this great array of evidence, as well as these intelligence whistleblowers like Colleen Rowley and Robert Wright and Sybil Edmonds coming out, and Richard Clark now as well, and we also know that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission, Keenan Hamilton, actually have said that the commission was set up to fail. And we also know as well that the person who oversaw the commission was Paul Wolfowitz, as you mentioned, and sort of arch neocon, who now, interestingly, has been appointed as one of Barack Obama's intelligence advisors. I think just, you know, from that, there are so many millions of who are saying we don't agree with the evidence out there. We need a new independent inquiry. And for the fact that there wasn't even a commission for the first year and a half and, until there was enough family pressure from the victims' families, the very fact that they have been caught out on so many fronts, apparently, I think there is an overwhelming need for a proper independent commission. I would say that the initiative of Senator Mike Gravel in the US, his Democratic initiative, is amazing to get states at the state level, not the federal level, to institute citizen and judicial inquiries, independent judicial inquiries into 9/11. It's well worth supporting. I would urge anyone who's listening to this show to Google Senator Mike Gravel and support his initiative, because I think at least there would be a certain degree of independence associated with that we haven't had with any of the commissions that we've had so far in 9/11.
What you're giving us is an insider's expertise on how the intelligence agencies such as M15 that you work for and the CIA coerce the media to give fraudulent accounting of events. And this would include how intelligence media manipulate conspiracy theories that emerge in order to keep information secret and discredit alternative views. Could you please go through some of the evidence that you have from your own personal background, so you're speaking as a first-person witness, on how you found that your own government in the United Kingdom lied, and then any evidence of that you may have had of co-conspiracy between the CIA and M16 or M15 on how they lied. And finally, once you brought this out as a whistleblower and you gave evidence in court, so you provided forensic hard evidence that these lies occurred, conspiracies occurred, what happened to you? You had to go on the run. Why did you go on the run? What was the likelihood, had you not gone on the run, that what would have happened to you? Could you give us that, please?
Well, certainly with the in the UK law, we have the Official Secrets Act that makes it a crime to report a crime if you work within the intelligence agencies. So, for example, you work as an intelligence officer, you see murder, but you are the criminal if you report that to anybody other than the head of your own organization, so the head of MI5 or the head of MI6. You can't even go to your representative, you'd be breaking the law. You can't go to the police, you'd be breaking the law. That's how tight that law is. So in terms of going public about it, our thinking at the time was, and of course this is pre-populist internet, YouTube, you know, everything, WikiLeaks, we thought the only way to try and effect change was to go to the national media. So we knew it would be a risk. We knew we would risk going to prison, being prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. But we decided that if we went to the newspapers and it was a big story, and it was, that there would be enough fuss in the media to push the government to have a proper inquiry, proper investigation into these issues of false flag terrorism, and that changes would be made. Now, unfortunately, the timing was slightly off because we went public, the story was huge, but then the weekend after, 1 week into the story, Princess Diana died in a tunnel in Paris in 1997. So that sort of wiped out any media interest in anything other than the Princess Diana death. So we sort of found ourselves lost in Europe. We decided to go on the run because we didn't want to just sit around in our flat in central London waiting for that knock on the door from the secret police, because we knew that if we were still in the UK, they'd arrest us, they would put us in prison on remand awaiting trial for up to 2 years. And we wanted to be free to fight our corner. So we had to leave the UK, literally go on the run around Europe for a month, and then hide out in France for another year, and then there were arrests and everything. But we lived in exile for 3 years, so it was very, very difficult. And in terms of watching what the media did in our case, it was quite a wake-up call because, I mean, I come from a family of journalists. I had a sort of faith in the fact that the press, the fourth estate, as it's called in the UK, will always dig for the truth. But in fact, what we saw was how pervasive government and intelligence spin could be in terms of controlling what the media covers, particularly, for example, during David Shaler's trial in the UK in 2002 when he was convicted of a breach of the Official Secrets Act and went to prison. What was said at the end of the case was an official ruling by the judge who summed it up, and he said he accepted that there was that what David Shaler had done was in the public interest, that there was no financial motivation and that no agent lives had ever been put at risk. And yet, and the journalists were sitting there writing it down, and yet the headlines the next day across all the UK media said exactly the opposite. Shayla sold agent lives down the river for money. So you have to wonder, at what stage does the story get inverted? Because, like, you know, I knew some of the journalists. I knew that they'd been gagged to a certain extent, and some had been prosecuted for covering the Shayla disclosures. So I knew that some of them would try and get the proper story out. But the headlines were the opposite of what was said. So either it's pressure from the government, it's pressure from the intelligence agencies, or it's pressure from the management in the media that is switching the truth. So it's reporting the opposite of what was said. And that's just very strange to watch, shall we say. But as I mentioned before, there are various levers and mechanisms that can be used to control the media. Journalists don't have time to investigate. They're on a treadmill to churn out stories. There will be agents of influence within the national media offices of any major corporation. Agents of influence being people who are friendly with the spies or friendly with certain government departments and do them favors by tipping them off to adverse stories or by planting good stories or by putting a good spin on a story. But also, as I mentioned, there's a particularly malign area of the intelligence agencies. In the UK, it's called IOPS, Information Operations, which plants fake stories in the media. And, of course, once it's in the newspapers or it's on television, it becomes fact. So there's a number of ways of controlling this. And I think people need to be very aware of that and also to read different types of media and alternative media, compare what is being said in those different outlets, because that's the only way you can get any sense of potential truth between all the sort of cracks. And particularly as well, I think a lot of people were very angry and upset about the run-up to the Iraq War. As you mentioned, all the lies about the weapons of mass destruction and things like that, and they didn't exist. But in the UK, we had an additional problem where MI6... Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, Annie.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Please continue.
The line's going funny. But in the UK, we had an additional problem in the run-up to the Iraq War where MI6, the James Bond, the intelligence gathering wing, claimed to have intelligence documents that proved that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Niger. And they used this as proof, we have to stop Saddam Hussein, we have to invade Iraq, otherwise you'll get a nuclear bomb. And then it turned out that these intelligence documents were completely fake as well. So either MI6 was sold apart and looked like fools, which they wouldn't admit, or MI6 knew that they were fake but used them anyway and used their credibility to push for the war. So that's on a sort of same level as Curveball, the intelligence agent in Germany that you mentioned. So, I mean, there's many, many ways that they can try and influence and try and manipulate the media. And one particular thing around 9/11 was in 2008, a document was leaked from a government-sponsored think tank report in the US, which was written by a man called Cass Sunstein, I don't know if you've heard about this one, where he was looking at the burgeoning 9/11 truth movement and the way that the word was spreading, how many millions of people around the world were getting very concerned about the potential lies told about 9/11. So his recommendation was to infiltrate the movement, was to cause division and argument within the movement so it split and fought amongst itself, and also, of course, to ridicule it, to call them all conspiracy theorists. And this was government policy formulated by a government think tank paid for by the US government. And lo and behold, since 2008, I would say that has happened to the movement, you know, these millions of concerned citizens around the world.
Okay. Well, just a final thought here. What I hear you saying is that there is the truth, but do not rely upon our official government and agencies or the intelligence agencies in particular to be the ones that bring forth the truth as easy as can be based upon what the politics are at a given agency or those supervising that agency. They can make up stories. They can suborn perjury. They can falsify information. They can intimidate, harass witnesses. They can gag the media. They can send you to prison if you tell the truth, even if you're telling the truth from inside an agency like M15 or M16. If you know a conspiracy exists and you tell the public a conspiracy exists, your very government that you are informing of this conspiracy now considers you equal to any of the enemies of the state. So you make it look as if it's very difficult, especially in England, to be the person who has the courage to tell the truth to the public, which could send a very strong message to everyone else who knows the truth might want to say it out of a guilty conscience, but then looks at the consequences to people like yourself who had to go on the run after being inside the intelligence agency of M15, seeing the truth, seeing the cover-up, seeing the conspiracies, seeing the lies, seeing the obfuscation, and then saying, my God, now I'm at risk and I have to run. Weaker people will not come forward and do what you did.
I think more and more people are beginning to try to do that. I mean, certainly as well, the landscape has shifted since the 1990s. Now we have outlets like WikiLeaks, and the technology is out there for other similar groups as well. So in the future, perhaps whistleblowers coming out of government or the military or the intelligence agencies won't have to sort of throw away their whole lives just to expose crime on the part of their employers, if they can have the protection of the technology offered by people like WikiLeaks. So I think that's one step forward. Of course, what happens to WikiLeaks itself, blazing the trail, and its spokesman, its chief founder, Julian Assange, of course, I think, you know, the US government is going very hard after him, trying to find any pretext to get him and to prosecute him in order to discourage others. But the technological gene is out of the bottle. There's no going back. You know, that technology is out there and it will be used again. But I would also mention as well, in the US, President Obama has actually used the provisions of your Espionage Act, 1917, which is similar to the Official Secrets Act. It's not quite as draconian. It's not quite as designed to stifle whistleblowing. But he's used it, I think, 7 times since he's come to power, which is more than it's ever been used before 2007. So suddenly, there again, in the US, there does seem to be a big push to stifle the exposure of wrongdoing and crime within the intelligence agencies, and they will use the full force of the law to try and stop that. So it's an interesting sort of repression. I have to say, living in Germany, of course, they do still have a sort of psychic memory almost of what it was like with the Gestapo in the World War II, what it was like in East Germany under the Stasi, the police state there, up until 1989. So they are very, very aware of how easy it can be for a democratic country to slide into totalitarianism, to slide into a police state, to be brutalized to that point because of fear of outsiders.
Annie,
so it's very interesting living in a country that does that.
Annie, many of us believe that we are on our way to America becoming a fully totalitarian state where the power of the government and the power of corporations dictate what our agenda should be. That's totalitarianism. And then that from there becomes how they exercise it, becomes fascism. And all from a group of plutocrats who control everything. And now they're controlling the access, except for the Internet at this point. My last few questions. Was there not a scientist in the early 2000s who was going to come forward in England with some truth that would have been embarrassing the government, and suddenly he committed suicide, and yet he had no background, no medical records that would have shown that he would have been suicidal?
Yes, you're referring to the Dr. David Kelly affair.
Yes.
In fact, it's way murkier than that. I mean, it's such a mess, this thing, because this guy was a world-renowned weapons inspector. He'd been to Iraq many, many times to look for weapons of mass destruction. He was a biological warfare expert and one of, you know, right at the top of his professional tree. And this guy was allowed to brief journalists on the quiet occasionally, but he briefed one journalist with too much truth once. So it caused a huge row between the government and the media. He basically said that the case for the Iraq war had been sexed up, or words to that effect. And this caused a huge scandal. He was hauled in front of Parliament. He was grilled by parliamentary committees, everything. And then suddenly he was found dead in the woods near his home in Oxfordshire in the countryside. And as you say, there was no record of depression. I mean, his daughter was about to get married. He was looking forward to it. He'd been talking to his friends the day before. And there are a lot of unanswered questions about how precisely he might have died. And there has never been a formal coroner's inquest into this alleged suicide, which is required under UK law. It's never been done. And what we have been a couple of political inquiries which have sort of edged around the actual mode of death and talked about the argument that evolved between the media and the government about what he said. So the poor guy is still sort of not put at rest yet. And we have at the moment a last-ditch attempt by a group of very senior doctors in the UK who have been campaigning for years saying there is no way that Dr. Kelly could have killed himself in the way that we are told to believe, which is that he severed a vein in his wrist and took some procalcitonin or something it's called. It's a sort of pain reliever, quite a strong one. And there are so many different aspects of what is wrong with that story, that his body appeared to have been moved. There wasn't enough blood to have caused his death from the severing of his wrist. There was no procalcitonin in his bloodstream, or very little. There were no fingerprints on the knife he was supposed to have used. I mean, all these different aspects have never been explored. And again, this is something that is being covered up. And the media, generally in the UK, will point the finger at these very senior doctors and an MP, a Member of Parliament, who has done extensive research into this and has a very good track record of exposing crime. He reckons that Dr. Kelly did not commit suicide as well. So there's all these people campaigning for this. And in fact, our new government, before they were elected, said they would have an inquiry into his death. And now they're saying they won't. And the papers around his suicide, Dr. Kelly's suicide, have been classified as top secret for the next 70 years under UK law. I mean, this is a guy who's supposedly committed suicide. Why on earth are they making these documents secret for the amount of time that normally only spy documents would be kept secret? So there are all these unanswered questions. And the media here is very complacent about it. There's one or two newspapers that might write the occasional thing, but it's being sort of squeezed out of the national consciousness, and people are not being allowed to question it. And if they do question it, they're seen as nutters.
My final statement before we end our interview here today. One of the reasons that we invited you to participate was because if, and this is merely a hypothetical at this point, if any members of the intelligence community knew in advance, and we have more than enough compelling evidence that that is actually the case, of the 9/11 plot, and chose to use that 9/11 plot and allow them to go ahead and carry it out, but at the same time serving a larger geopolitical interest from parties that could benefit from a war in the Middle East, and a shift in the power structure and the natural resource ownership in the Middle East, then it could only be done by those individuals who have power within the intelligence community. So therefore, many feel that the intelligence community in the United States has fingerprints all over 9/11, and yet these people have not been called to testify. Individuals who have solid proof, absolute proof that they were informed from inside the CIA and other national intelligence agencies of the events before 9/11 occurred, and pass this on to the White House, pass it on to the Secretary of State and to the Secretary of Defense, that we were not surprised by 9/11. Then who would have had the means to have participated on any level in the cover-up? Who would have had the means, and what would have been the motive to have extended a false flag initiative? That's why I've invited you, because no one has been inside the intelligence community, worked in the intelligence community, saw the corruption, crimes, malfeasance, cover-ups, and conspiracies inside, saw terrorist acts committed from inside the intelligence community and blamed on others as false flags. You have. So your contribution to today's program is based upon that question that is raised. Well, gee whiz, you know, the intelligence community is there to protect us. The media are there to inform us. And you're showing us, hey, depends upon who you are in the media, like the New York Times, the Times of London, repeatedly have been shown to have stories that could have and should have been brought to the American public's attention and were not. The FISA disclosures, the New York Times held that for over 11 months and knew about illegal spying, unconstitutional spying, wiretapping of all American homes, and chose not to break the story. So that is why you're here to tell this story. Final thoughts. And by the way, what was the worst crime that you saw committed from inside your FBI, your M15, while you were actively employed there, that that the world public and especially Americans would not have known of, but would have been appalled had they known, that was covered up by your government?
Well, that would have been the Gaddafi plot, the attempted assassination in 1996, where MI6 was funding a bunch of Islamic extremist terrorists with links, known links to Al-Qaeda, however you want to describe that sort of ideological franchise, at the time. And it went wrong, it was illegal under UK law, and innocent people died. And I can't really think of anything more heinous. And as I said, that was brushed aside, spun by the government, spun by the intelligence agencies, and the whistleblower was put in prison. There was never an inquiry into the illegal acts by MI6. There was never, you know, a proper investigation. So I'd say that's probably the worst thing I saw, and it certainly gave me a very clear view of what the media can be done to the media as well by the spies, how you can sort of suppress a story, where they can dismiss it. In those days, they used to call it pure fantasy. Now they just say it's conspiracy theory, no doubt. But, of course, you know, it's all been proven that that did happen now, that Gaddafi's fallen. So in terms of the intersection between the media and the spies, it's a sort of revolving door. I mean, there's a very cozy relationship. The media no longer holds the power to account. It is part of that power structure. And in terms of the spies, it's very easy for them to sort of divide up who works where. So there's a sort of need-to-know principle. So, for example, with the Gaddafi plot, it appears that it was a small team of officers in MI6 going ahead and doing this illegal operation. Most people didn't know about it. The only reason that David Shaler was officially briefed about it was because he was head of the Libyan section in MI5 and he had a very close working relationship. That would not normally have been known. And I think in terms of the run-up to 9/11, there have been many, many whistleblowers coming out now saying that information was not passed between agencies, that they were actively blocked from looking at some of the suspected terrorists in advance. People like Robert Wright from the FBI and Colleen Rowley from the FBI, Sybil Edmonds from the CIA, have all talked about being blocked from active investigation of people who are of interest. And you have to ask why. And also Richard Clark, one of the former senior spies in the US, has recently come out and said that there was active blocking of the free flow of information between the CIA and the FBI. So it may well be that they're trying to cover their backs because there was an intelligence failure before the attack, but it doesn't rule out the possibility that some of them knew that something was going on, that they suspected something might be going on, but, you know, let's see where it goes. They would call it realpolitik. I think the rest of the world could probably just call it murder.
And Annie, thank you very much. I appreciate your contribution to our program today. And for those of you who have not read her book, Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, MI5 and the David Shaler Affair, please do so. Anna McShawn, thank you for being with us today from Germany.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. As we're concluding our three-hour special today on a new look at the 9/11 investigations and deconstructing the most obvious and blatant errors, omissions, and falsehoods, let us go back to England with Ian. Ian, please give us your summary of what we should take away from today's insights that will allow us to better focus upon the truth of what happened at 9/11.
Okay, Gary. Well, I'd say that what's not going to change with 9/11 is that there are two sides to it. There's the physical side, what you could call the physical side, what happened at the Pentagon, how the towers collapsed. And then in the middle, I suppose you've got the sort of semi-physical, how did they take over the planes? How could they have flown the planes? And then you've got what you could call the paper trail. Why didn't the FBI capture these people? Why did they appear to be protected by the CIA, according to these latest bombshells that we've had from the White House, from Richard Clark, from Ali Soufan of the FBI? And of course, also these reports from Saudi Arabia about the Saudi Arabians possibly being involved in helping to organize the hijackers. I would just caution, in connection with those reports, that you know, you've had these accusations that Israel was behind the 9/11 attacks. Now we're getting accusations that Saudi Arabia was behind them, and then, you know, there are also accusations that Pakistan was behind them. Let's remember that none of those people had control of the Pentagon. They did not have control of the FBI. So let's be on the lookout for the CIA trying to shift the blame from what we now pretty much for certain know, which is that Richard Clark has confirmed, which is that the CIA had the vital dossier. They kept it from the FBI. Had that dossier been given to the FBI, as they asked repeatedly for, the 9/11 attacks would never have happened, whether they were organized by the Saudis, the Israel, or Pakistan, or indeed, as a lot of people suspect, by rogue elements in the CIA. So that's the paper trail side, and I think, you know, things are looking... There's been a lot of action on that side in the last few weeks, no doubt about it. Things that were just deductions made by researchers such as myself, or, you know, people like Barbara Honegger or Mike Rupert in the early days, things that were just deductions are now up there with quotation marks on from people like Richard Clark, from leading FBI investigator Ali Soufan. Now, they're not, of course, accusing the CIA of having intended to create the 9/11 attacks. These are friends of theirs. You know, these are people they've been working with for years. But the fact that they now recognize that there was a decision in the CIA is, I think, highly, highly significant for attempts to get to the truth about what happened over 9/11.
Most importantly for me, Ian, is that no longer can any responsible or reasonable journalist, politician, policymaker, or indeed the American public, just cast aside any challenge to the official report as vain, conspiratorial, a nut job, people without any care for the truth. In point of fact, it is now coming forward as the truth that we have been lied to. So the official report, as being the first and last word on this, is no longer the first and last word. And I thank you and all the others for participating in today's program. I'm Gary Nall, concluding a 3-hour investigative report. We will have more in the future as new evidence emerges. I want to thank Anning McShawn, former intelligence officer for M15, Professor Peter Dale Scott, Barbara Honecker, who also was from the inside the intelligence community and the White House, and others such as Professor Niels Herrett and Commander Ted Moga and the others. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live from New York City.